Alone from Alice in Chains, our brand new number one song.
We want to thank Jason Statham for hanging with us, and his new movie Redemption is out now.
Get caught up on the entire chart by punching up the SideshowCountdown.com. I am Nikki Six.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we will see you guys next week.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Hey, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
Are you all ready? It's been a couple of weeks.
Yes, of course. A couple of nutty weeks.
Nutty weeks, yeah. Jolene and I were off last week. Jolene off the week before. So you have not had your Night Call fix in...
I haven't.
What does that make it, 3 weeks?
Yeah, I'm only going to get half of it this week because I'm going to be doing kind of double duty. Our producer, John, had an emergency, and so we are on our own with our phones. This ought to be interesting. If you call in and I simply put you on hold, just stay there and we'll get to you. Okay.
Like Jolene just did. Now, here's the deal. We are in one studio here at WRIF. There's a second studio where the line rings. John Miller, our producer, picks up the phone and says, "Hi, Night Call. Do you want to talk to Peter and Jolene?" And then you tell him what you want to talk about. And then he sends us, how would you say it? There's a linking
description.
Screen.
But here's the deal. I'm not even going to ask you what you want to talk about this week. I'm going to ask you your name and where you're from. And then it's surprise night for you, Peter. I'm going to run back in here and.
I was thinking we wouldn't even do that. Let's just put people on the air.
Well, we could, but.
What the hell?
You know.
All right.
We'll do what we can.
Here's how you
this
do it.
This has never happened to us.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. Well, because here, what we used to do, we'd have windows between the two studios and you could just hold up, in fact, if it was the old studios, you could even broadcast from in there, right?
I probably can go in the other room and broadcast, but I don't know how.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm certain we can link up these studios.
Yeah. Are we on the air?
We're going to need to learn how to do that.
Yeah. All right. Here's our number if you want to try out our new system. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And hey, if you'd like kind of stay up to date in what we've been thinking about, at least a lot of this is mine. In fact, it's all mine. It says that on the website. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. If you'd like to see what both of us are thinking and what issues we're dealing with, you can go to our Facebook page. That's Facebook.com/Night Call. If you'd like to join us via email, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And one of the things I'm happy about, the incredible poster artist, Gary Grimshaw, from back in the old Grandy Ballroom, back in the 1960s and early 1970s, who did all these great rock and roll posters, he and Lenny Sinclair, who was very instrumental in putting all that together, along with her husband, John Sinclair.
Ex-husband. Former.
Ex-former, right, yeah. Has a brand new book out called Detroit Rocks, A Pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 1975.
Wow, cool.
If you're old enough, you can reminisce. If you were born...
If you're just interested enough,
I was going to say, yeah. If you were, be like us reading, you and I reading something about the 20s.
You do it all the time, bro.
I do. Well, as Jolene said, lots happening. Voting rights really took it on the chin. The conservatives on the court said that 5-4 that the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which applied mostly to 9 states in the South, that they could now change their election laws without advance federal approval. In other words, for so many years, their behavior was so egregious in terms of denying people the right to vote, just screwing with the electoral process in general. Of course, it began when they excluded people of African descent, African Americans, from voting at all. And those are all Democrats. And what they wanted to do was to keep a white monopoly on the vote. Well, that all switched. And as soon as they began letting, listen to that phrase, letting black people vote.
Right.
Isn't that white of them, as they used to say, right? The white people said, we out of here. We got to y'all get into the Republican Party, right? And so that's where they all are. All the white people are in the Republican
Party.
Well,
they certainly, it's yeah. But the majority. I mean, a 0.0000001%.
Yeah. So the idea was, and this, according to Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., he says our country has changed. And certainly a lot of the attitudes have changed. All of a sudden you see people like Paula Deen and you wonder how much has it changed. And
I wondered that before Paula Deen.
Yeah, right. We can talk about that. But the egregious denial of people's right to vote is in many ways worse, because at least under segregation, not that this was a positive feature of it, but it was overt. You could see it. And here, of course, it's hidden behind the idea that we want to protect the integrity of the vote, because there's now all these voter ID laws, because the day after the Supreme Court held that the Voting Rights Act of 1965, at least this one important section, was invalid, unconstitutional, Texas put in this strong ID requirement law. And the thing is, they are fixing a problem.
I mean, it's one thing to require a driver's license.
Then, no, you don't even have to do that, I don't think. You have to have some state ID. And you think, what, doesn't everybody have state ID? Yeah, most middle-class people have it. But the farther you go down in the social class structure, mm-hmm. the less people tend to have that, and the more intimidating it gets. And the Republicans have been in people's faces. They've pushed through these laws that have nothing to do with problems at the voting booth. Because think about this. Here's who fixes elections. Politicians do it. In other words,
and corporations, which are the same thing.
Yeah.
And Diebold, sure. one corporation that ran the machines owned by Republicans, blah, blah, blah.
Now,
and your bank machine.
And one of the things that happens, for instance, is that whole groups of people, usually minorities or people that are targeted as possible Democratic Party voters, they're excluded by secretaries of state, or the early voting hours are restricted, or the number of poll places in an area are, or what this phrase gerrymandering, which means that you take these districts and stretch them all out of shape so that they bring about the political content of a legislative body. So we've mentioned.
Can you bring that down a little bit?
Okay, here's what happened. In the congressional.
I mean, I understand it, but that was.
Okay, in the congressional elections of 2012, last year, the Democrats got five, in the House of Representatives, the Democrats received 5 million more votes than the Republican candidates, yet the Republicans have an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives. Well, how in the world did that happen? Well, what happened is that the Republicans were able to rig the system so they could shove as many Democratic voters into a single district, no matter how. I mean, you would think districts would be like square, right?
Yeah.
Except they look like these monsters, or these Rorschach inkblot tests, or dragons and stuff like that. So even before, and that was, you know, done in Michigan and Pennsylvania and places like that. So they're literally, I know this is supposed to be a right left of the state, but there literally ought to be a federal standard so this kind of stuff doesn't happen. And, I mean, one of the things would be if there was fair access to the polls, and these districts weren't all, you know, screwed up like this, the Republican Party would probably disappear, which would be, oh, then you'd be, I don't know. Let's just leave it at like that. 313-298-WRIF. All right, that's all the bad news. Well, let me just read.
That's not all the bad news. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
And by the way, if you say, Well, I don't care. It's minorities, you know, African Americans and Hispanics. I'm white. I don't care. Well, what begins to happen is that the Republican Party, who is solely the mouthpiece of the wealthy, that has no interest in the average middle class or working class or poor person, is going to have a free hand. And everything that many people that identify, if you can imagine identifying politics by race in the 21st century, that there are still people out there that do that.
Yeah.
They are just looking for you to be part of their long-range strategy to return us to, well, I would...
The Dark Ages,
yeah,
let's put it that
1920s, way. 1920s, 1880s, you know... No standard of living worth calling American as we've come to know it. One of our favorite journalists, Greg Palast, wrote this thing. Ku Klux Klart kills King's Dream Law, replaces Voting Rights Act with Catherine Harris Act. Catherine Harris was the Secretary of State of Florida. Now, she was in charge of voting in 2000. This is when Bush stole the first election. And she was able to exclude all these African-American voters. In fact, we wouldn't even have heard of the Bushes. We probably wouldn't have had a war in Iraq or a war in Afghanistan if the election, as Vice President Biden said the other week, that Al Gore, who won the election in 2000, would have been properly seated. But they were able to exclude people that were Democrats. So here's what Greg Palast said. He said, I'm looking for this one. Oh, yeah. He said the Jim Crow. Jim Crow is another phrase for segregation. The Jim Crow majority on the Supreme Court just took away the vote of millions of Hispanic and African-American voters by wiping away Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And so, like you say, well, I don't care. I'm not one of those. Remember what Romney wanted to do? Remember what these Republicans want to do? All that? It ain't good. But here, you say millions? What do you mean millions? When I say millions of voters of color will lose their ballots, I'm not kidding. Let's add it up. Last year, the Republican Secretary of State of Florida, Ken Ditzner, tried to purge 180,000 Americans, mostly Hispanic Democrats, from the voter rolls. He was attempting to break Catherine Harris's record, who I think blew off about 120 African-American voters. Detzner claimed all of these people were illegal aliens. But Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act requires that the 16 states with a bad history of blocking black and brown voters must pre-clear with the U.S. Justice Department any messing around with the voter rolls or voting rules. And so Section 4 stopped Detzner from this racist, what he calls, brownout. I'll admit there were illegal aliens on Florida's voter rolls. Oh.
Peter, I think to get the show going, we can get back to this, but I think let's start off on a note. Let's take this call. Oh, he's gone.
Yeah.
Darn it.
Two of them.
It was a conservative who said, the riff is getting pretty liberal, and I simply said, this show's been on the air for 43 years.
Yeah, shove it, pal.
Put you on hold.
Yeah, I'm, you know.
I know, call back.
Yeah, call back.
Call back.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Anyways. You got me right at the climax.
Sorry. Well, I was...
Hope you don't do that in other parts of your life.
Oh, Peter! Don't even go there!
I wasn't. You misunderstood what I meant.
No, I didn't.
Anyway, so that the Secretary of State of Florida claimed that there were 180,000 illegal aliens. Well, it turned out there were illegal aliens on the voter rolls. Two of them. Two.
Two.
Of 180,000.
So all this ado about nothing.
Let me repeat that, says Greg Palast. Two aliens. One, a U.S. Marine serving in Iraq, not yet a citizen. The other, an Austrian who registered as a Republican. Sorry. So that's the bad news. The good news is that the Defense of Marriage Act, what a stupid name for that law anyways, was declared unconstitutional. And the joy and the outpouring of happiness and love, it should melt even the coldest conservative or right-wing Christian.
And
you don't think so?
What happened, basically, for those who don't know what DOMA is, and a lot of people don't.
Defense of Marriage Act.
Is, yes, that the Supreme Court said that this act that basically said that federally, right?
Yeah.
Federally, that marriage is defined as between a man and a woman. And basically it was, you know, just trying to protect their precious heterosexuality, and because they're afraid of homosexuality and gay love. And that has been struck down. It's gone. So now people in California who were able to get married before, then weren't, now can again. Yeah. And I'm going to go get talk to these people on the phone here, Peter.
All right. And also it had to do with the fact that gay people were in a relationship but weren't legally married, were they were denied the benefits in 1,000 different laws. And so, Jalene put forth a theory. You join us, 313-298-WRIF. She said that they were trying to protect their heterosexuality, that they couldn't deal with gay love. I have literally no idea why people have, find this, the people that do, the majority of people now support gay marriage. You know, like 5 years ago, they didn't. A lot has happened. And as Chief Justice John Roberts said, when DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, was signed in 1996, there was not a political unit in the entire world that allowed gay marriage. It was overwhelmingly, the law was overwhelmingly supported by both parties, and it was signed by a Democratic president. Now, what was it, 50 years ago or so, Bob Dylan saying the times they are a-changing, but it shouldn't have had to be. Remember, you ever hear this phrase, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible. Here's the key line, with liberty and justice for all. Didn't say for all, but, I mean, it should have, when it was written in 1892, it should have said liberty and justice for all, except for women, for gays, for blacks, for Hispanics. A lot of people were still excluded then. But this was the Republic's ideal. It was written, by the way, by Francis Bellamy in 1892. He was a Baptist minister also. You ready? You ready, conservatives? A Christian socialist. And he was a cousin of the socialist utopian novelist Edward Bellamy. He wrote an interesting book called Looking Backward. How about this? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, and that means everybody now, are created equal. They are endowed by their creator. The only time this appears in either the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That would seem to include everyone as well. And the reason I would think that in this secular document, that nothing like a creator's even mentioned in the Constitution, but there had to be some anchoring of where rights came from. I mean, they had the right of kings and stuff like that, but we had to say our right as citizens, not as subjects of kings or anything, but as citizens with rights that could not be alienated by government because the majority of people didn't like you fill in the blank, right? I mean, you went to Nazi Germany, a Jew couldn't marry a Gentile or something like that. Or here in the United States, up until 1967, a white and black person couldn't marry. One more thing, the 14th Amendment, and this is really where it falls on. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And I'm skipping a little here. Well, it says, or deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So how could these four conservatives, you know, they're just a bad joke. I mean, when you say conservative, that's a synonym for bad joke, awful joke. Because if these people had any allegiance to the Constitution, any allegiance to our founding documents, any allegiance to this pledge that kids still say in school, how in the world could they say that this law, the Defense of Marriage Act, is constitutional? Now, Justice Kennedy, he was the swing vote. He said the federal statute is invalid, for no legitimate purpose overcomes the purpose and effect to disparage and injure those whom the state by its marriage laws sought to protect in personhood and dignity. That's actually a pretty complex sentence, and maybe that's not the best one to read. By seeking to displace this protection and treating those persons as living in marriages less respected than others, the federal statute is in violation of the Fifth Amendment, it says. Scalia went, bonkers, and he said, that takes real cheek. That's an old-fashioned way of saying, you're messing with me. But he said, by formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage an enemy of human decency, because what's being said here, I mean, it's two things. There's an ethical and moral argument that's not being made by the court. It's something that's strictly consistent with the Constitution of the United States. But there is, to most of us, an ethical and moral content to this, that people shouldn't be hurt, that people shouldn't be injured, that people shouldn't be discriminated against because of the choices in life. And it doesn't matter whether two people dislike them or their choices, and the them can, you can fit in any particular group when you go throughout our history or the history of the world and see what's been done to people that the majority of people don't like. It has real horrible circumstances. Sometimes it's mere discrimination. Sometimes it's mere just saying you're not a full citizen. Sometimes they round you up and put you in concentration camps. But they have to start with this dehumanization. You don't deserve the same legal protections. You don't have the same rights. So hooray for this decision, and I don't get it. These gay marriage opponents then right away asked the court to intervene and said, hey, stop those people in California from issuing marriage license to same-sex couples. Did you see those happy people? I mean, what? Here, again, I'm a long-time married guy, right? I'm the white, middle-class, heterosexual guy. And
yeah, you are.
Yeah, I am. And how has this harmed me? That's the one thing these folks could never come up with. They religious opposition. Don't do it. No, or tell people you think it's bad. Tell people, that it's an abomination before the Lord or whatever. I'm sorry. I'm being a little disparaging. Yeah, I am. Tell them whatever you want, but don't try to have your prejudices, or wait a minute, I'll take back that word, your beliefs transformed into law. Because they ain't hurting you. All right, hey, it's Gary in Pinckney. Gary, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I was just listening to you on the radio, and only thing that, I like listening to different viewpoints. One thing that caught my attention was when you were reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, you didn't say under God.
Well, that was put in 1954. Doesn't belong in there. That was put in as a Christian interruption into what had been originally written and recited for over half a century by a man who was a Baptist minister who didn't feel any need to put it in there. That under God was like promoted by Billy Graham and people like that, saying we have to show that we're a Christian nation and all that.
Was it the Knights of the Columbus or something?
Yeah, probably. So anyway, I was reading it how it was originally written, and I would never say under God anyways. I don't even understand that mean. What does that mean, one nation under God?
I don't know. Doesn't that seem like that's just something that brings us all together, though?
No.
No, I think it's something that separates us.
It separates us because how many religions are there in this country alone? How many do you think?
Oh, I no idea.
Well,
too many.
According to people like you, there's one.
No, I said it. I like to listen to different viewpoints, and you're talking about our Constitution, and you're talking about our government, and then when you recite the Pledge of Allegiance, you don't say under God.
Well, I let me say one more time. I was reading it how it was originally written, was number one, and number two, that was put in there in a way that I think is inconsistent with the First Amendment of the Constitution that says there should be no establishment of religion, and I would never say that ever. What do you think about that?
Well, like I said, I like to listen to different viewpoints, and I just wanted to know why you didn't have it in there.
There you go. All right. Thank you. Sorry. I don't know why. Gary, I'm sorry. I'm sounding a little strident tonight. I'm not sure why, but thank you very much. And that was a good question, actually. All right. Let's go. And again, we're shy of phone screener. And so we're going to have to sometimes just ask you who you are. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
I'm Dan from Canton.
Hi, Dan. How you doing? I'm doing good. How about you? What do you think?
Well, I wanted to comment on the gay marriage thing. I don't necessarily think gays and lesbians really know what they're asking for. If they want to be miserable like the rest of us, go ahead and let them, you know? Because, I mean, you look at the divorce rates now, I mean, you know, if that's what they want, I don't see the problem in it, you know?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, there are some, I'm sure, just like there's people, heterosexual couples that don't want to get married. I'm sure there's probably lots of gay people. Here's the problem, though. And, you know, let me tell you, people, everybody might not know this. The suit was brought by this woman named Edith Windsor. She was a lesbian, a gay woman, who is in her 80s, and her partner died. And for one thing, you don't even have the right to go into a hospital. They say, who are you? And they say, I'm her partner. And they say, well, huh? You can't. Sorry.
Yeah, even if you've been together for 30 years, which I think they were, or 40.
At least, yeah. And then, but the worst thing was that her partner had left her this quite a large sum of money, you know, like $375,000. Or no, it must have been a much bigger than that. I think the tax was $375,000. Which he would not have had to pay if they would have been legally married. So that's one of the thousand ways in which, if you can't consummate a marriage, that legally, that that's one of the disadvantages. But thank God, you can welcome to the misery of marriage. I hear you. All right, thank you very much. That's odd. Everybody wants to get married, and maybe they don't anymore. But then. We got people saying that. That struck me as something I wanted to look for something, and now... Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Here. This is a headline. I think this is a right-wing paper, the Washington Examiner. It says, President Obama in his statement,
sounds like it,
hailing the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act, promised he wouldn't try to force religious institutions to conduct gay marriage. On an issue as sensitive as this, he said, knowing that there's a wide range of views, blah, 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 how religious institutions define and consecrate marriage has always been up to those institutions. Nothing about this decision, which applies only to civil marriages, changes that. Now, that sounds pretty good, but here is what I was thinking about that. I mean, for one, yeah, you don't, if you're a church and you say, you know, we think this is an abomination before God, you don't have to marry them. But, you know, these are tax-exempt
institutions. Churches do not pay taxes.
Yeah. And one of the things,
which they should.
The Public Accommodations Act, the reason that the Supreme Court could hold that segregation 60, 70 years ago was unconstitutional is because it was public transportation. And in the same way, places that are licensed, you can keep anybody out of your house who you want. White people, black people, brown people, Jews, Hungarians, whoever. It's your house.
Hate who you want.
Hate who you want. You can let hate eat you up. But you cannot be a bar licensed by the state of Michigan and keep anyone out who is legally can legally enter. So I don't understand, since churches in many ways operate at the largesse of the taxpayer. In other words, they don't have to pay any taxes. And think about the property that some of these places own, the Catholic Church, for instance. But anyway, they're authorized by the state, and they affirm the civil marriage contract when they marry somebody in a religious ceremony. They're an officer of the state. Right? If a priest or rabbi or an imam or somebody like that, they're not just an independent contractor. It's not a religious ceremony. It's a religious and a civic ceremony. So maybe they ought to be required to do it. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Angeline Jordan is answering the phones and then running back here. Here's Dan in Canton. Dan, hi, you're on the air. Welcome. What do you think?
Hello, Peter.
Hey, Dan?
No, this is Maurice, Peter.
Yeah, it is Maurice.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Were you trying
Hey, Maurice, sorry.
Did you tell
I've been
Jalene?
Running back and forth. No, I knew it was Maurice. Okay. I just had it all screwed up. Okay. I'm not in that room very often anymore.
Yeah. Go ahead. What's up? What's on your mind?
Well, I like to talk about things in Detroit.
Sure. Me too.
No, you remember last year, right after the horrible World Series, I told you Detroit team cannot hit left-handed pitching. They're having a problem now, and the bullpen sucks.
Yep.
You're talking baseball?
Let's move on forward. No, I'm like this. Somebody
He's putting it all together, Peter.
All right. I was going to say, call Dave and Chuck the Freak in the morning.
Go ahead, Maurice.
I got a bad... That left a bad taste in my mouth when it got rid of Drew and Mike.
Okay, anyway... Back to what you were talking about, Peter. Way to go.
Okay, like I was saying, let's talk about Charles Peel. Who in the right mind, knowing that a dude is gay, let him around some young boys?
He's talking about Charles Pugh.
His phone cut out. That's why we didn't
hear
that. Yeah,
Charles Pugh, who was the president of the Detroit Council and is MIA. He just disappeared.
Yeah.
He was using
money from his youth fund, and there were allegations of messing with someone younger.
That is exactly the
headline in the newspaper.
They said that he had given this kid a cell phone and some money. But
allegations of inappropriate behavior is what the journalists are saying.
I don't think it was behavior. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I don't have any reason to defend Charles Pugh. But anyway, he was cited in Seattle in a coffee house by a Michigander.
Right.
But what's happening here is just amazing. And for those of you not around here, Detroit has an appointed financial emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who has come in and is now essentially the dictator of Detroit. He has just told the Detroit Police Officers Association and the sergeants and lieutenants that no more contract. He's hired a new police chief for $225,000 a year.
I was astounded.
Yeah. The current pay range for a chief is $85,000 to $140,000. He's paying this guy from Cincinnati $225,000. Also, city council member Gary Brown, who was also a Detroit police officer, was just hired by Kevin Orr for $225,000 a job as an assistant to Orr. I mean, this thing is such a racket. And anyway, whether you think that the Detroit police should have a contract or not, whether you think that Charles Pugh ought to be stripped of his pay and his powers the way Kevin Orr just did, that doesn't sound a lot like a democracy, does it?
No, but what does Maurice think? Because we haven't even let him make his point.
Yeah, go ahead, Maurice. Maurice?
Hey, I'm there, Charles. Peter. Thing about it is...
Yeah.
Know that a guy is gay, Charles. Why would you let him be a mentor around young boys?
Here's the thing. That's the stigma that all gay men are... some people think that they're all pedophiles, which is... There couldn't be anything further from the truth. It really, you know, so... I mean,
there are some adults that are attracted to children. There are...
And I doubt that's what he was about, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I was reaching...
I mean, there are pedophiles, and then there are just gay men.
Yeah, because, for instance, here, the co-founder of the Minutemen Civilian Border Patrol Group, that remember, those were those people that spent several years looking for unauthorized immigrants crossing into Arizona. He was just arrested on Wednesday on suspicion of molesting three young girls. Chris Simcox, who co-founded the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, was booked into a Maricopa County jail in connection with the molestation of three girls under the age of 10. So there are some...
Now, let me guess. He's married with his own children.
Probably. Oh, yeah. No, he was a kindergarten teacher.
Oh, even better.
Well, here's what I'm saying, Maurice, is that there are some adult men that are, for some twisted reason, are attracted to children. The worst is actually carrying out the fantasy. The second thing is, the pornography of it, which actually involves children being molested. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. So, but it's not particular to heterosexuals or homosexuals. But here, Kevin Orr, the emergency financial manager of Detroit, hires this new Detroit police chief from Cincinnati that who will be getting more pay than the mayor of the city of Detroit.
You would think someone who is in working for the city and sees firsthand the state of what's going on down there would say, you know what? Don't give me that much. Why don't you cut it down to, I don't know, $150,000?
Exactly.
I'll take that.
Or how about just the range for the police chief, which is about $85,000. But here, Detroit cops are leaving. And now the dictator of Detroit, Kevin Orr, says that he's ending the contracts with the police and with the sergeants union. And guess what they're doing? They're out of there. They're leaving. How is this guy going to fight crime when police officers are leaving? So what they'll wind up with are police that are working for $22,000 a year.
They already don't make that much.
No. They make a pretty decent
wage.
Well, it is dropping.
Yeah, it's been dropping. The last pay cut was 10% of like a year ago.
And to pay police low wages is absolutely a guarantee you're going to wind up with corruption, for sure. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Any number of you on hold, and we'll be right back and get more of your calls. We don't pay this guy to not tell you the phone number. Here it is.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend brought to you by 7-Eleven. Quench your thirst with a 69-cent Big Gulp at 7-Eleven all summer long. Just one more way 7-Eleven makes your summer awesomer. Oh, thank heaven. The Riff. 101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
I was 21. The night was fueled by whiskey and bad decisions. When I woke up, my back was in pain. I rushed to the mirror and I couldn't believe what I saw. I had gotten a butterfly tattoo on my lower back. Now I'm 40, with kids and a wife. I couldn't go to the pool and my kids were asking me questions. I needed that mistake off my body. I tried traditional laser removal, and after 12 painful sessions, the doctor told me I had 10 more to go. Then a friend told me about the Skin and Vein Center's new procedure called PicoSure. It's a tattoo removal procedure that takes less than half the time, and the pain level is totally tolerable. This new technology erased my mistake in only 3 sessions. It was truly amazing. If you have tattoo remorse, call the Skin and Vein Center and erase that mistake forever. Here's the number, 800-400-VEIN. That's 800-400-8346, or go to skinandvein.com.
PicoSure tattoo removal, only at the Skin and Vein Center.
Hey, babe. I know you're the chameleon with the great eye, so I wanted to talk about the color we painted the living room.
Oh, that new Cosmic Berry? It's great.
Yeah, it's good. But Valspar has the Love Your Color guarantee, so if we don't love it, we get another color free.
We do love it, so no need to change.
Are we certain we love it?
We love it. We didn't love having your mother stay with us for a month.
We didn't have a choice.
We are chameleons. We always have a choice.
Offer ends 10/7/13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
Imagine never getting off your couch again to find your VIN for a car insurance quote. Infinite couchdom. Thanks to Esurance Express Lane. That's insurance for the modern world. Esurance. Click or call.
Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
101 WRIF. Locking in everything that rocks. 101-WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. We're talking about the Supreme Court decisions, one that overturned the Voting Rights Act, at least one section of it, and it's just going to lead to more suppression of the vote
and more fraud on the part of the man, not the people.
The man, I love it. This is terrible news. 19 firefighters are missing in an Arizona wildfire. This is incredible. Wow. Bravery those men and women
and
now
women.
Show.
I have two female friends who are down there. I'm worried sick about them.
In Egypt, one of the largest crowds ever assembled in human history is in Tahrir Square demanding that the president of Egypt, Morsi, and the Muslim Brotherhood get out of office. We'll see what comes of that. We're talking about the Supreme Court decisions, the one that overturned the Voting Rights Act, also that overturned the Defense of Marriage Act. One of the things we've been talking about, we being Julene Jordan and I, is we never understood. Well, you were out of the room when I said that. You said that there was this fear of homosexuality. There was this desire to, you know, just affirmed heterosexuality, which mm-hmm. is kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
But no one has ever really successfully articulated what exactly is the harm done if men marry men and women marry women.
What is the harm? We'll never quit asking that question. And the day someone gives us a real answer, well, it's not going to come.
Well, what is said is that traditionally, and that's certainly true, I mean, homosexuals, gay people throughout history have been pillared. I mean, and it still remains. Did you know that Barack Obama was in, I can't remember the country, but the first African country that he went to, that the president of that country, where it's illegal to be a homosexual, homosexuals all throughout Africa are arrested, beaten, tortured.
Yeah, it's many horrible. Countries around the world.
And, hey.
I mean, even in Cool Man, Jamaica, it's not cool to be gay, man.
No. Yeah, the Russian parliament passed a bill a week ago Tuesday that imposes a fine for what it calls propagandizing non-traditional sexual relationships among minors. And it's the latest of one of these socially conservative new rules. Hey, that reminds me, by the way, those of you who have HBO, there is an incredible, and this fits right into this, there is an incredible documentary about the group Pussy Riot, the three women who
the
were... The Russian group
who
went into this Orthodox
music
church.
Group.
Music group. A punk music group, and started doing this song denouncing the president of Russia, Putin.
And two or three of them are still in prison.
Two of them are still there. All right, yeah. Let's get back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Drew in New Haven. Drew, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I have a comment about when you were talking about Pledge of Allegiance earlier.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't this country built on Christian standards?
What gives you that idea?
Well, were our forefathers not Christian?
Well, a lot of them weren't. Some were, some weren't. Some are what they called deists, which they said that a God had existed and kind of pushed the universe into being, and then the rest was all up to us. But they, the First Amendment to the Constitution, the first thing that it says doesn't guarantee the right to free speech or free press or to assemble for redress of grievances. It says Congress shall not be able to establish a religion. I mean, they were very concerned because they were
being squeezed by the Catholic Church.
In England and Europe, they saw that.
And so they didn't want it here.
Yeah. There's no mention, for instance, of Christianity in either the Declaration of Independence or in the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, where it does appear, about religion, it says there never shall be a religious, I don't have this in front of me, I think it's in my briefcase, but it says no religious test shall ever be required for office, for instance. Although some states actually have that you have to be, you can't be an atheist, right?
Okay.
So anyway, that's one of the myths that the right wing puts forth, that somehow this is a Christian nation. It's not. It's a secular nation, and which welcomes within it all religions. Christianity has long been the dominant religion, but it shouldn't be allowed. And most liberal Christians, every Christian I know, doesn't want it to exclude others. And when you have the conjoining of religion and the political state, it usually corrupts the political system and the religion as well. I mean, look at the Catholic Church. I don't even mean all this sexual abuse scandal, but right now there's this huge financial scandal with the Vatican Bank, some Monsignor trying to bring in like $50 million in cash in a private plane. Now, this is... No, that's not the way we want to go, and that's what the Founding Fathers thought as well. All right, thank you very much, Drew. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Amanda. Amanda, hi. You're in Stars and Stripes?
Well, I actually just got home. It was a long line. It was a great show. Hellstorm rocked.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Yeah. What's up?
Well, you know what? I'm listening to you right now.
Go.
I just wanted to say something to you about, you said something about churches being tax exempt. Why are they tax exempt?
Right.
Well, I'm very involved in my church, and first of all, the money that's donated to them is already taxed out of people's paychecks. So that would be one reason why they're tax exempt.
No, wait. When I go into a store, you know, the money is already taxed as well. I mean, But go ahead. I'm sorry. Let me let you finish. Go ahead.
Well, secondly, I mean, at least the church that I spend a lot of time at, we do so much for the community. We build houses for the community. I mean, we do food. I mean, we must feed, 180 families in the Sterling Heights area. I mean, there's just so much that we do. I think we're more of a charity than just a church.
Oh, that's good work.
A lot of churches are like that.
Well, you know, I guess it depends, too, on you know, where it all winds up. When it winds up like that, I mean, I know Christian people and Christian churches that have that take vows of poverty. That and I'm not saying that everybody has to be poor because you're in a church, but certainly there's people that do good work. But there's also, when you think about some of these lavish properties and when you start looking at, like I say, these financial scandals within the Catholic Church and the Bank of the Vatican and all that, you wonder what's going on here.
Yeah, well, there's going to be good with bad, but isn't Planned Parenthood, aren't they tax-exempt as well?
I don't know. That's interesting.
You don't know?
Tax-exempt. Sure, tax-exempt.
And they get grants from the government.
They
I
don't?
We don't
want to do anything to help women's health or anything.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that we don't want to help women's health. I'm saying that, a lot of people get up. I mean, I used Planned Parenthood. Grew up poor. All I'm saying is, if we're going to allow one side of it to, you know, because they do abortions, if we're going to allow one side, then we have to balance it out, because that's what America's about.
Well, you know, I have to check on it. You've made some good objections. I like that when I'm challenged, and I like it even more when I can't come up with a real good answer. So I will look into that. But you know that Planned Parenthood, what percentage of their work is abortion? Something like 7%.
Very small amount.
Okay. I'm just curious why you made that point.
Well, I know she said.
Oh, I'm missing
half the show, by the way.
Wait, she's missing half the show, and then she's saying, I'll tell you why. She said that if Planned Parenthood is tax exempt, then a church that, like hers, that does all the charitable work, why should it pay taxes?
The two are completely separate things, though. That's my opinion.
Okay.
Reason I'm missing half the show is not because I'm not paying attention.
Right.
We are phone screenerless.
Yeah.
For the first time in night call history.
So she's running around like crazy. But Amanda, that was some good points, and I'm going to check them out, and I'll see what's what.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, too, actually.
Right. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Amanda. Keep up the good work.
I wasn't meaning to be snarky, if that's what
you mean. Right. Okay. Here's Randy in Westland, wants to give a correction. Hi, you're on the air. Turn your radio off, okay?
Hello?
Randy, hi. What's up?
Not much. I can turn the radio off. I'm driving too. I just got back from Stars and Stripes too. Actually, I'm still driving.
Okay.
I was just calling because Just the one comment about people when they came to America and the Catholic Church. I don't think it was the Catholic Church so much as it was what they call the Church of England, because by then England had separated itself from the Catholic Church because they didn't like the rules, and like King Henry VIII, he wanted to make up his own rules.
Right.
So that's you know, they kind of separated themselves from the Catholic Church.
They did not want the papal authority or King Henry VIII. Henry VIII. I am Henry VIII.
I do understand and agree, and the founding fathers did not want a church having control of the government. But it's not to say that, like, I get, you know, when people say, "Oh, you can't have a nativity scene in front of City Hall because of, you know, separation of church and government." I don't think that's what they meant. What they meant was the church cannot have control of the government. Not to say that, oh, you can't mention God or you can't have a nativity scene in a public place.
Well, I'm not sure.
But for God's sake, no pun intended, the nativity scene should be in front of the church. I'm offended as an atheist walking up to any city building that has anything religious-oriented whatsoever.
I can understand that. What I'm saying is, when they made that separation of church and state, their meaning was that no church could have power over the state like many of the European countries had. They were all run by a religion. Or like in England, they created their own religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what they were doing was they just didn't want that to happen. I don't think they were even thinking about a nativity scene at that point.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they weren't. But
look at how much religion has crept into our government. It's more than I'm personally comfortable with.
I mean, why is there a law designating a national day of prayer, which is almost, although people like President Obama has tried to make it a little more inclusive, still, it's inappropriate for a secular government to be affirming religion.
With anything, yeah.
Now, why does religion need this? You know, if for one thing, if it's an all-powerful God, I mean, why does his followers think that he always needs such a constant affirmation? I don't get it. All right. Thank you very much. I have to go right now, but I appreciate that correction. By the way, here, this is from an article in the New York Times the other day. It's called A More Secular Europe, and it says church attendance is falling across Europe as belief in God wanes and even cultural attachments wither. The continent's The continent's fastest growing faith is now Islam. In Britain, according to a poll last year, more people believe in extraterrestrials than in God. In the European Union as a whole, according to a 2010 survey, around half the population believes in God, compared with over 90% in the United States. All right, back with more after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
At Advance Auto Parts, summer heat can melt down your car battery faster than a snow cone on a hot dashboard. That's why, in Advance, we test your battery for you. Free. Need a new one? We'll install it. Also free. No reason for you to get all hot and sweaty. Come to think of it, no reason to put a snow cone on your dashboard, but that's irrelevant. Fast, free battery installation only at Advance Auto Parts. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Most vehicles, most locations. See store for details.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff. Riff.
It's Ann Carlini here, and if it's anything on two wheels, then I've got everything you need to know. The Riff Hogg Report, brought to you by Jerry Aaron, the motorcycle lawyer who rides at 1-800-MI-BIKER. See more at WRIF.com/Hogg Report.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
It's back to the links, July 22nd, the 2013 Riff Rockin' Golf Outing. Details at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. If you want to go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Lots of stuff there about the recent Supreme Court decisions, about the release of the new book by Gary Grimshaw and Lenny Sinclair about the old Grandy Ballroom and Detroit rock and roll in general. It's called Detroit Rocks, a Pictorial History of the Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 1975. A couple of weeks ago, I aired an interview with Jeremy Scahill. He's the author and of a book called Dirty Wars. You go to dirtywars.org, and it is now a documentary.
I was going to say, isn't that a movie now?
It was a book, and now it's, incredible, absolutely incredible documentary about the U.S. drone war, which you can say, well, that's pretty grim. It is.
Wars.
Yeah, and it's done it's cinemagraphically. It's amazing. It won Best Cinematography at the Sundance Film Festival for documentary.
Cool.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, the Republicans did this gotcha thing because they said that Barack Obama's IRS was targeting conservative groups whenever they saw, like, Tea Party or Patriot or something like that. And they were applying for this tax-exempt status that they would give them special attention and try to block them, right? Because, actually, they were scamming. They were, because what you have to show is that you were a social welfare organization, and they're not, right? So
the Tea Party?
The Tea Party, yeah.
They're not.
Guess what? The instructions that Internal Revenue Service officials used to look for applicants seeking tax-exempt status with Tea Party and Patriots in their titles also included groups whose names included the words progressive.
Oh.
And Occupy.
Like Uzis and Measies.
Yeah, right. And the documents back up the contention, the contentions by the IRS officials that the agency didn't single out conservative groups for special scrutiny. Instead, they were trying to use what they call keyword shortcuts to find overtly political organizations, both liberal and conservative, that were after tax favors by saying they were social welfare organizations. So, but it went more than that. One such be on the lookout list included medical marijuana groups, organizations that were promoting President Obama's health care law, and applications that dealt with disputed territories in the Middle East. So taken together, the documents seem to change the terms of the scandal, don't they?
Yeah.
That instead, the dispute now revolves around this questionable sorting techniques, that's for sure. So it's another scandal that didn't happen. Right. Okay. Let me look. Well, here. We've got callers waiting. I wanted to bring up this stuff about Paula Deen, but we can go on later.
Well, all we have to do is say Paula Deen.
Paula Deen.
Discuss.
Yeah, right. I will say one thing.
I mean, she has been all over the news.
I used to be, here, this is a public admission. I used to be a much superior cook to Jalene Jordan. I was. You hardly knew how to boil water.
That has never been true. College it was.
And
long time ago.
But now it is Chef Jalene, and she can outdo me in all the culinary skills after having graduated from
Schoolcraft College culinary program. Yeah.
Right. Right. But Paula Deen, who would was a cook on the Cooking Channel. Is it the Cooking
Food Network? And there's also one called the Cooking Channel.
Right.
She's got cookware lines. She has books.
Cookbooks,
she has frozen foods.
Oh, wait.
She's got everything.
I want to go there. Here's what I'm going to say. Anybody who takes a pound of butter, you know, 2 cups of sugar, a quart of cream, and then make something with it and says, oh, they're such a great cook because everybody loves it. Well, of course they're going to. You know what I'm saying?
Anything that is fat, salt, laden, yeah. sugar laden, or fried is going to taste good. Well, now she has admitted that she used the word,
the famous word, the N word,
the N word. And
we are launching into her, but that's okay.
And an S storm, therefore, yeah. happened. She's lost her contract with Food Network. She's lost all of her book contracts.
12 Walmart corporations.
Walmart even got rid of her crying out loud.
You know what's the worst, though? Besides that, she has been promoting this poisonous diet, of which she, as it turned out, was a victim herself.
Mm-hmm.
Because
as a diabetic.
Because she came out as a diabetic. She was a corporate partner with Novo Nordisk, a Danish pharmaceutical company that made this... this diabetes medicine called...
Is it metformin?
What?
Is it metformin?
Oh, no. It's in here somewhere. I will find it. But anyway, that she had this lucrative endorsement deal. And
dangled in front of her face, and she took it. But she had known for 2 years
But she didn't mention it for 2 years.
Yeah.
That she had diabetes.
And she was still making shows with all of this.
Yeah.
Fat and salt and food that, sugar is the main one when it comes to diabetes.
She's been the public face of the company's diabetes medication, Victoza, since January 2012, when she simultaneously announced she had type 2 diabetes and endorsed the drug. The timing set off a storm of criticism that Ms. Dean, whose cookbooks and television shows promote the lavish use of sugar and fat, had misled her fans and acted opportunistically because she had received the diagnosis 2 years earlier. She'd been paid $6 million.
She has so much money. It's not even funny.
I had
Hopefully
no idea.
She saved it.
12 corporations handling her stuff. Sears blew her off and all that. And her cookbook has shot up to number one. Well, she's a racist. Let's go buy her book. What kind of human beings do that?
It's like the gun thing. We might not be able to buy any of more Paula Deen books. They're going to take them off the shelves. What are we going to do?
Well, I'm a lot softer on her than I think you may be. I mean, I tolerate no racism or...
Zero
tolerance for racism. But she got her butt kicked, and good for it. And I don't really care what happens to her one way or another. She's probably, no matter what happens, she'll continue to be a multimillionaire.
Oh, yeah.
She has her restaurant. Where is it? Somewhere in the South Atlantic.
Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
She's got two restaurants. That's how this all came about, because her brother, Bubba, Uncle Bubba's Oyster House, that's where this woman worked, and therefore sued for racial discrimination and harassment.
She was white.
I don't know.
Yeah, she was white. The woman who sued was white and said that they constantly used the N-word. They were anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did not know she was white.
Yeah. And what's
That's
good,
even more amazing to me.
What's good is that we live now in a society where people don't tolerate that stuff. And the people that feel, white people that feel comfortable with that kind of discourse, using that kind of language, she's paying the cost.
Yeah. And then, you know, of course, someone will call and say, well, now if they can use it, why can't we use it?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's a cultural thing. Simple and period, whether it's an ugly word or not. Trust me, I hang out with a lot of African Americans, and I hear that word a lot.
You still, I was going to say it's
more like
a 70s and 80s thing.
No, not at all.
I haven't heard it much.
Would I ever say it? Hell no.
No.
I'm going to go get this phone call.
I'm going to just tell you one thing.
What,
there's a great, what's that martial artist guy that always.
Chuck Norris?
No, the Asian guy, the Chinese guy. You know what I mean.
Jet Li?
No, the guy, they're kind of comedies.
Okay.
Rush
Jackie
Hour. Jackie Chan.
God.
There's a scene, where was he, with Chris Rock?
Yeah.
Where here's Chris Rock goes into somewhere in Harlem and uses that word in front of him. And so Jackie Chan is
thinks he can use it?
Yeah. So a brawl breaks out.
Yeah, but of course he kicked everyone's ass.
No, he did. Because he was wrong.
Yeah, don't do it, people.
Let me say, though, that word and the reason, the power that it has when spoken by white people, that frequently or always was the last word that an African American heard before they were lynched or burned. So, but you know, let me just go back a little and why I say I'm a little softer on her. I read this. She's been talking to Paula Deen has been talking to some African American ministers, and one of the things that the Black Baptist Church talks about and was best articulated by Martin Luther King Jr. was the beloved community. and that the idea is not to defeat your enemy, but to, and this is, we always talk about Tai Chi, neutralizing that person and bringing everyone within, inside of the beloved community. And yet you got to be willing to do it, though. And you have to drop the hatred. You have to make some changes. And I think that Paula Deen has been properly chastised.
Well, she has. I mean, I tried to watch her apology on today's show. I got through about a third of it. It just made me nauseous.
My prejudice is when someone starts saying y'all. You know, and all my friends from the North, they wind up living...
Well, there's nothing wrong with y'all.
Y'all. You know.
There's nothing wrong with that. Now you're being a
Northerner.
A wordist. Wordist.
I never get back. You know, I mean, all I'm just thinking about my great-great-grandfather in the Civil War that got shot by some Johnny Reb. I'll never forgive those people.
Listen, y'all, we got some phone calls to take, y'all.
Yeah. I always, you know, I got friends from the North, and they say, y'all going, you know, they come up here and they say, y'all going. I say, why are you saying y'all? And they go, huh?
it's simply, you know, geographical. There's a lot of cultural things.
Yeah.
Just how it is.
We all give us a call at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike in Clarkson. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, how you doing?
We're doing good. What's up?
I was just touching base on when you were talking about the nativity scenes in government. They all go back and say what the forefathers intended at the time. I mean, the simple fact of the lack of science back then for religion, I think is... You know, science has kind of explained a lot of things where people used religion to explain back in the day.
True.
I love that.
On the other hand, you know, Mike, like I say, they weren't a particularly religious crowd at the time.
How did we end up with "In God We Trust" on all of our money still today?
Well, that began, I think, like I can't remember, but it wasn't at the time, and I don't even. Again, I'm not even sure what that means or why religionists feel the necessity to insert this everywhere. If God is all powerful, everything must be laid out in advance. If he's omniscient, in other words, all seeing, he can see the future, so he knows what's going to happen. And so, you know, this nonsense about free will just doesn't even exist.
Well, that's what I mean when I say science. I mean, back... People did all kinds of things, from rain dances to everything, to try to understand why things were happening to them.
I'm about rain dance.
I'm down.
We're done with rain dance.
I'm ready to do one right now. Yeah, he just said the magic words. Hug a few trees while we're at it.
Right. I mean, you know, I understand why everyone believed in all these stories and different religions from different regions of the world. But, I mean, science has kind of stepped in over the last couple hundred years and really explained a lot of things to everybody.
Well, yeah. Don't I always tell this story about the Zen monks and about the one night that the senior monks are awakened by this hammering on this is long, you know, like 16th century in Japan, this rattling of the monastery gate. You know, you're my audience. Jalene, where are you going?
Sorry,
she's got to go answer the phone. And here's this disheveled young monk, and he says, "What's the matter?" He says, Master, I haven't slept in 3 days." He says, "What is it?" He says, "I must know the meaning of life." And for that statement, the senior monk smacks the young monk in the head with his stave, and he says, "There, that'll give you something serious to think about." In other words, I don't think those larger questions are ponderable. I mean, does it really seem possible that we are in the on this orb that is going around at how many miles an hour and not throwing us all off and our oxygen not dissipating? And I mean, thinking about that, I mean, I don't even, you know, when someone says to me, "What's the meaning of life?" I say, "What do you mean by the meaning of life?" I mean, I'm right here, right now.
That's deep, man.
Yeah, deep. Yeah. All right, man. Thank you. I got you.
So Bart wrote in to call talkyes@yahoo.com, said, "Unfortunately, what most everyone fails to notice is that the text of the First Amendment reads that Congress shall make no laws about religion. It says nothing about religion keeping its greasy fingers out of government." Thanks, Bart.
Oh. Here's Scott in Detroit. Scott, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
We're good. What's up?
Religion has been the worst thing that has ever happened to this planet.
A lot of people say that.
I mean,
including you, Peter.
It's killed more people in its time than Hitler, Stalin, and the Black Plague combined. The Inquisitions, the Crusades, I mean.
It has a nasty reputation, I have to say. Well deserved. But, you know, I want to go back and, like Amanda, who called in earlier, those are the people of the religionists I know, the particularly Christians and Jews. I know a few Muslims, not very many. And they do such good work in their lives. They're such good people. They're so tolerant. They often, through their religious institutions, help other people. But, you know, and that's good. And if that was what defined religion, I would say, good. That's a good thing. But you're right.
Yeah.
Here's what I don't understand. And maybe, I don't know if you can explain this, Scott, or anybody else can. If these people believe in an all-powerful God and that they're in touch with it and they're immersed in institutions that affirm that belief, why do they get so upset when people, they say, insult God? I mean, blaspheme or, you know, so why would they care if somebody insulted the Lord of the universe? What would they care if I insulted the Lord of the universe? What difference would that make?
Because you're insulting them. That's the whole deal.
Well, they should get over it.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, if he's so all-powerful and omnipotent, why would he create us just to worship him? Does he got an inferiority complex or what? If he's all-knowing, he would have known this would have all been one big mess and not do it in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Did you hear me? I did an interview the other night. And we were talking about the image of God, and it's always like this, you know, like old man, I mean, very stern for some reason or other, and with long, this huge head of long gray hair. And I was thinking, if I was God, I would have myself be permanently a extremely buff 28-year-old, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I just came in at the very end and something about an extremely buff 28-year-old. Do I want to know?
Yeah, I was going to say God, which is portrayed so often as this elderly man with this long head of gray hair.
Yeah.
If you were God, wouldn't you be like a 28-year-old? Well, or if you think God is a she.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Or why? Anyways. And let me say this. If you know, there are some people... it's funny. People that get angry at talk like this, I vacillate by saying too bad.
No offense.
And no offense. Yeah. And if it's real, which I don't think it is, then, you know, no harm, no penalty. If you think about it like that, because if God is all powerful, and he has his ways. My best Christian friend, who took this up just a couple of years ago, hope is listening, he said he doesn't believe in hell. He thinks Jesus died for all of our sins, that doesn't care whether you believe in him or not, accept him or not. There was a universal sacrifice.
Okay. And I know who you're talking about. That sounds like him. Because for someone turning to religion to the level he has, he's cool still.
And everybody I know who is religious, who never brings it up in social context unless you bring it up with them, they're good people. And if there was no religion, they'd be good people anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think people like Amanda, who said she's doing good work for her church, if there was no God, no church, she and her neighbors would probably get together and do that same kind of charitable work that they're doing.
Like my sister does all these missions to Jamaica.
Yeah.
But I don't know if she would have done it without the church.
I'm
not putting her down. I'm just saying some people need an organized group to get them to do something like
there that. There is this power of feeling a lot, how would you say it? immersed in the transcendental, something that explains all the mystery of life. Why are we here? What happens when we die? Why did what about the ceremonies of birth and coming to man and womanhood, marriage, death, all of that?
Okay.
I mean, religion can play a role in that. And the people that are like completely secularists. I remember I interviewed a guy one time that wrote a book called The Trouble with Christmas. It was this atheist. And I said, well, what do you do on Christmas? He said, I go to the office. And I go, whoa.
So do I.
Well, yeah, you come here to I know. So, there's functions that are served. And our favorite religion, Buddhism.
Yep.
They are.
Which really isn't a religion, it's a spiritual way of life.
Well, it is in Myanmar. And there's murderous groups of Buddhists killing hundreds and hundreds of Muslims. So there is, as one of our callers says, this murderous impulse that accompanies most organized religions, or maybe even all. And I don't understand it. If it's a God of love, I mean, everybody should feel, that is religious, should feel so sorry for me and Jolene and everybody I know.
Well, I know some who do.
Yeah. And pray for us.
I said, please don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. If you pray for us, we appreciate it. All right. Let's see. Where are we at here in the scheme of things? 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mitch in Romulus. Mitch, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Okay. I don't want to be antagonistic on this issue, but I just want to state that I'm deeply troubled by this atheism that you put forth. I think, as a lifelong student of the Bible, which helps me to make sense of this insane world, I think it says in there quite clearly that it is appointed for once for man to die, and then comes judgment. And, within the recesses of each man's heart, each human, they know that very well that there is a God.
What are you saying? Every human, including mine?
Yes.
Well, that's quite a presumption on your part, my friend. What gives you the slightest idea? I mean, I should be even crueler and ask you what even gives you the slightest idea that a God exists, but that's too broad. I'm saying, but please do not enter my heart without my permission.
Well, the thing is, we must have, some moral parameters, set forth. Because, clearly, atheism establishes, a slippery slope in regards to morality. And we see that being quite evident today.
Wait. Don't you see it the other way around? I mean, the millions of people that have been killed through religions, I was saying, like the Crusades and the witch burnings and the any number of things and what the Hindus do and what the Muslims do. I mean, it's not exactly something you'd like to adhere to. I mean, you would love it if they would have adhered to "Thou shalt not kill," right?
Well, the point is that Western culture, in the easier United States were established on the basis of Christianity.
No, they weren't.
No.
Go ahead.
And all the laws, established in this nation are basically, from a, divine viewpoint,
Well, no, you keep saying I don't agree. I don't agree. You got to go back and read, something different about this.
What can I ask what religion you are, if you don't mind?
Well, what do you think?
No, I mean, what specific sect of Christianity are you?
No, I'm just a student of the Bible. I don't adhere to any. I don't even go to a church. I'm just a student of the Bible, and it's a lifelong study. It never ends.
Well,
My friend has read the Bible 15 times. He was a student of a Bible, and it turned him into an atheist.
Well, see, God in his sovereign nature establishes within the heart of man the soul of man, a faith,
Can't you have faith in anything besides the Bible? Are you really serious?
Well, wait a minute. Let me say, you're going to find this very insulting and maybe even cruel, but these are just words. And they're your opinions and you want to live by them, fine. But,
pray for us.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Goodbye. In Stark, Florida, a group of atheists have unveiled a monument to their non-belief in God. This is just on Saturday. We're on Monday already. On Saturday, to sit alongside a granite slab that lists the Ten Commandments. Now, this is where these religionists are always trying to thrust religion into the public square, even though the Constitution forbids it. So these atheists from this group called American Atheists, they just said, okay, we're going to go the other way. We're going to put this huge 1,500-pound granite bench with all these what they call free thought sayings on it. As they did it, there was a group of about 200 people supporting them in this small town in northern Florida, but a small group of protesters blasted Christian country music and waved honk for Jesus signs. And this one guy, I like it. Let me see, who is this? Oh, that's David Silverman. But there was another guy that, Eric Hodvin. He belongs to Something Christian Today, and he stood up on the new atheist bench and preached his Christian beliefs. Good for him.
And the atheist probably said, whatever.
Whatever. Yeah, go ahead. Do your thing, as they say. Here's Dan on beautiful Harson's Island. Hi, Dan. Welcome. You're on the broadcast.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yep. I just had a comment regarding Paula Deen.
Sure.
The fact that she basically told the truth in a deposition, I think she's being penalized for telling the truth.
You know what I mean? She should have just lied and not ever said that.
Well, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it would have served her better, but being a truthful person sure hasn't paid off.
And well, the effect wasn't in that actual courtroom. The effect was what spilled out of that courtroom because of what she said. You know, I mean, people aren't going to tolerate racism anymore.
You know, and well, it was something
she could have lied under oath. You're right.
Yeah, and you know what, Dan? She could have handled it much better.
Because when they asked her, "Have you ever used that word?" she didn't say, "Well, I hate to admit it, but in 1962 or whatever," she said, "Of course I have.
Y'all. Yeah. But, even the mighty shall fall. I think it says in some book around. All right. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's Michael in Fenton. Michael, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, I got to turn the radio down.
Yeah, do it. Do it to it.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're great. Leaves in the other room answering the call. Thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that city manager and the police chief.
In Detroit, hiring this new police chief for $225,000, yeah.
Yeah, but first, the Christian thing, you know, I'm a Christian, and, you know, I prefer that you were a Christian, but you're not. So I don't hate you for being an atheist. You know, I just hope that someday that would turn around for you, and, you know, and I'm not going
to. Well, I would prefer that you didn't tell me what to be.
I would prefer if one day you know, there's a lot. The head of the group, Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I would prefer if one day you didn't care what other people did and mind your own business.
Oh, no, you're being, now, come on, you're getting cranky.
No, I'm serious. Why are people putting this on me?
Well, I mean, don't you care what, I mean, don't you want people to agree with you? I do.
I don't care.
I do. I wish Michael, like so many Christians who have become atheists, I wish he would do that and make me happy.
I could give a rat's ass. Honestly.
She hasn't had a lot of sleep. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, me and Peter are on the same footing on that, just different beliefs. But the thing is with this, these politicians, they've proven that they don't have a lot of moral fiber. That we can tell by everything that's going on, that's the evidence.
And guess what? They all call themselves Christians.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, well, hey, on that note, Julian, I'm Christian. I'm not Puerto Rican. You know, if it wouldn't be for Jesus, I'd never make it to heaven. It's by nothing I ever would do would ever get me in.
Uh-oh.
What did he say?
If you want to get to heaven. All right, Michael, thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate your
call.
I got
to get these.
Jalene is running to the other room. What's happening? Some of you are just joining us. We do not have a phone screener. There was an emergency in a family. And so Jalene has to go in the other room to answer these phones. So thank you. Thank you for your patience. Here's Calvin in Bloomfield Hills. Calvin, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, yes. Let me turn the radio down. I'm calling in on the religion, what you guys are talking about, and it's sad because really a lot, I'm not saying that I have faith. I have faith in, like, something more, but I'm not trying to, I don't want to pin it down because I think everybody's got a little bit right and most of it wrong. I mean, it's sad that people, it's not really the religion that's the problem. It's the people use religion as an excuse to do bad things.
Well, I mean, if there's a pattern, doesn't that, I mean, if somebody said to you they were a Marxist-Leninist communist and they wanted to take over the government, wouldn't you be a little fearful that they would be, kind of run a police state? You know, I mean, the same thing. I mean, these folks, have not had a, you know, religionists have not had a good history in the world. I mean, there's good people.
Well, agreed. That's true. But, really, I'm not saying that it's excusable or anything like that. I'm saying that really what happens is that it's in our there are bad people out there. Okay, there are really bad people out there, and the worst of them look for the perfect keyhole to basically launch whatever they want, whatever it be hate propaganda, a foothold in some form of power struggle, you know, just to get. You know, money. I mean, like evangelistic preachers who turn out to be, you know, thieves and or whatever. It's religion is a perfect way for people to manipulate other people because there are a large amount of this world. We need people need faith to get through life. Life's hard, so they look to a god. They look to religion to help them, give them strength to get through every day.
Oh, that's what Michael said before it. So, I mean,
well, yeah.
I mean, so how do I do it? I mean, I'm facing the same challenge. And look, I mean, when I think.
I think some people need it and some people don't, and you and I don't, Peter.
Yeah.
I think
I mean,
it's that easy.
When I think of the religious people I know, I'm thinking of Reverend Bill Kellerman of Cath's Methodist Church.
How about, Central United Methodist, my friend's dad? Yeah, we've had this conversation before.
I didn't know that. Yeah. But his name has slipped right out of my mind. But a wonderful man, and you know, and does the opposite of trying to manipulate people. But the Central Methodist Church, Central United Methodist Church, has been in the forefront of
civil rights
and social justice movements for 120 years. Martin Luther King preached there right before he did the march down Woodward in 1963. And there was, in my absence here last Saturday, a week ago Saturday, there was a 50th anniversary march to commemorate that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see who gets it. I don't know what this is about. Cameron in Waterford. Cameron, what's this? I-75 fire report.
Yeah, hey guys, anyone traveling I-75 north, just past exit 67, get off the freeway. There's a huge fire going on right now. I tried to take a video with my phone. Quality wasn't too great, but yeah, get off the freeway if you're headed north.
Where,
there's no getting past that.
Where is it? What mile road or what road? Did he left?
Oh, that was my fault.
Oh, my God.
He said exit 69.
Seven. Thank you. Jesus. It was 67. It wasn't 69. So, anybody, give us a quick shout. Cameron, we cut you off accidentally. Where exit 67 is. All right. Let's go back. More people wanting to talk about religion. Josh in Redford. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome. Did I not do it? I didn't do it. There you go. Josh, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Nothing. You know, just about the whole religion thing. You know, I think a lot of people, like with the extremists and everything, I think they kind of got it all wrong. You know, I grew up Catholic, and, you know, I've read the Bible. My grandmother instilled it in me. You know, and there was a lot of things that didn't make sense. And, you know, and now that they're finding a lot of new findings on the early writings of Jesus and the omitted writings of Judas and the omitted writings of Mary Magdalene and everything
so forth and so forth. You know, when King James revised the Bible, he omitted a lot of things. And people forget that. You know, the original teachings was to be with your close friends, to transcend your body,
mm-hmm.
you know, transcend the spirit. And I think they've taken it to a whole new level, especially with the church. You know, the church, I don't believe in the church. I think the church is greedy and one-sided. And the fact that they have their grasp and their claws on everything and around the world, I think it's horrific. Because due to the fact that they're not teaching what the original teachings were.
Well, once anything becomes bureaucratized to the extent that an institution is, you know, 1,500 years old or more, yeah, hey, that it's almost built in that it's going to occur. I mean, I sometimes look at different churches, not just the Catholic Church, but of all the pomp and circumstance, of all the finery, and I'm thinking, wow, where in the Bible does it say to get dressed up like that and to have these ornate palaces for worship? I mean, I think there's a lot of it. I mean, even people that in pre-civilization tribes and all that, there was a tendency of people to dress up ornately and what have you. But come on, you know, it's a 21st century. All right, thank you. I appreciate your call. Let me do this. We'll get right back. If you're on hold, let's see. Pete and Rick and Nick, hang on. We got you next, and that means there's some open lines.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The riff.
Are you self-employed, stuck on COBRA, or did your health insurance rates just take a huge jump?
Listen to this.
I'm Josh Cush of J.P. Cush & Associates. You've seen the signs. And when I founded J.P. Cush & Associates, I promised myself that my customers would always get the best health coverage at the lowest rates. Call me now at 855-4-JP-CUSH before the rates go up even more.
That's 855-4-JP-CUSH to get a quote today.
That's 855-457-5874.
Or go to jpkush.com. J.P. Cush & Associates. 855-457-5874.
Sensational payments under $130 a month. Now at Sarah Kia at M53 and 30 Mile Road, right on the corner. Go Kia and get great gas mileage, head-turning style, and award-winning safety. Go Sarah Kia and get the lowest possible payment. You pay what we pay and not a penny more. Listen to this. This month at Sarah Kia, you can lease a 2013 Kia Rio LX for $125 a month. You heard that right. Just $125 a month. Lease a fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Soul for only $127 a month. Or the exciting all-new 2014 Kia Forte EX for $130 a month. All new vehicles come with Kia's 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty. America's best. Visit drivesarahkia.com for complete lease details. At Sarah Kia, you'll always get the most for your trade. And don't worry about credit. Come see us and we'll get you financed. Isn't it time you discovered the Sarah difference? Sarah Kia, M53 and 30 Mile, right on the corner. Sensational payments under $130 a month in June at Sarah Kia. You pay what we pay and not a penny more.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, this is our last segment for the night, at least. And we're going to have to work to get a podcast on, aren't we? Usually our phone screener, John Miller, puts it together, but we'll have something up.
And no, we have a way to do it. I'm going to put up a link tomorrow. It's called WhiteRoseSociety.org. All you have to do is search Peter Werby Show, and you can find it. And that's going to be the way we're going to have to do it this week.
Okay, and we'll give you a notice on Facebook. So,
yes.
Yeah, join us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/nightcall. I'm at Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And in just about 23 minutes, I'm going to be interviewing Jerry Lemke. He's written a book about, well, this is interesting. It's Hanoi Jane. You know who Hanoi Jane is? You may remember Jane Fonda, although he says it is not about Jane Fonda and talks about talking with her about the book. Very, very interesting.
Cool.
So it's Hanoi Jane. Sex, wait a minute, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal describes how Jane Fonda was elevated by the right wing to be the cause of why the U.S. lost the Vietnam War. Also, Kerry Addis, who's, are you ready for this, an aquatic ecotoxicologist, and Ann Stephen Seward, they're activists with the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands, and they're going to be talking about those huge, huge piles of pet coke, P-E-T-C-O-K-E. And this is left over from this tar sands process of getting this oil out of this tar sands up in Alberta, mm-hmm. which they want to, you know, then send the oil down through this pipeline, Keystone. But it turns out that the property it's on is owned by our friend Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge. And guess who owns the Coke? The Coke Brothers, K-O-C-H. So it's Coke Coke. That's all coming up. Let's get back to your calls, though. Hold on, and we shall do this. Here is Nick Nixon McComb. Nick, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, well, I'm calling because I, on the religion topic, and I live in Ann Arbor, and I go to the Zen Buddhist temple in Ann Arbor often, and I really don't personally care what religion you are. The thing that I hate is when the person of a certain religion is really mean and hateful towards someone else.
Sure.
And that's what bothers me, is when someone, like, you have great Christians who are great people that help out the community, and then you have Christians who are horrible, won't help anyone, and will follow the Bible to a T, and anything you do wrong is horrible. So as far as me, I don't particularly follow a religion. I started going to the Zen Buddhist temple to find peace for myself, and my wife goes too, and I find religion to be a joke most of the time because everyone takes it way too seriously.
Well, you know, Nick, I said earlier that the good people I know that are religionists would be good people without it, and you would think that the corollary of it would be that people that are bad people would be bad even within the religion. But there's something about the world's organized religion, the major religions, that's able to mobilize people in a hateful manner. And see everybody outside as the enemy of their God. And I'm so far from that mentality. I'm like, my parents were atheists. My grandparents were atheists. So, you know, some people were like the co-founder of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Dan Barker. He used to be a minister, and they have a whole program for ex-ministers who are now becoming atheists. They become so disillusioned with religion. So maybe they've had the feeling, maybe they had the idea that they actually heard the voice of God or Jesus within them, or they had some sense of belief, I mean, where it's 100% absent from me. And if you think about that, I mean, what am I supposed to do? Fake it? I mean, what? I'm in many ways, I am hostile towards religion because of what it does, so much of it does in the world. And, you know, like I always say, if the shoe doesn't fit, don't wear it. That philosophically, I mean, as I said, to be connected with the transcendent. Why can't I say that word? Transcendent. There you
Good
go.
Good job.
Thank you. It's getting late. With the transcendent, to have a community of people that come together to sing together. I mean, that's all, you know, a wonderful thing. But what am I supposed to do? Make it up? Say, yes, I really do believe. I accept him into my heart. When I don't, and am I going to be condemned to some fiery hell forever for that?
According to some people, we are.
Well, as I always quote Mark Twain, right?
Yeah.
About this time of the night.
What?
Heaven for the climate, hell for the company.
I love it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate it. Boy, all of a sudden, I don't know. Here's Rick in Farmington Hills. Rick, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
We're doing good. What's up?
I just found out from Jalene. I didn't know what this lady had said.
I told him a couple of little gems of that, yeah. Paula Deen. We're talking about Paula Deen.
Yeah.
So now that she has explained to me what Miss Deen said, what's the big deal? I mean, how she is, came out her mouth. Besides, I caught her when she said, I is what I is, so what's everybody upset about?
Yeah, well.
We got a big person that's up there that everybody's, you know, all rah-rah about. Now you find out that she didn't use the N-word. Well, I mean, she used the N-word.
She used the N-word. I think what the way we were, when Rick and I were talking when I was in the other room, he was saying, you know, she said it. She showed her quote-unquote colors.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Rick?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know.
Well, it's pretty interesting because, I mean, I haven't heard this in a long time, but I've been in situations with other white people where all of a sudden they come out with the N-word and I'm going, whoa, what planet are they on and do they think that I inhabit? And it's part of this uncomfortable feeling on the part of some white people that the world that they thought that they inhabited is slipping away, and to some extent it is. The replacement rate of white families in the United States is below zero, and particularly Hispanics, but also African Americans, is growing. And we live in a world of color, of which we are a minority, and somehow the idea that we're going to be relegated to a minority in which white people have come to think is, quote, our world, they're in for a big shock. But you know what? They're going to be long gone. And hopefully the kids today have making a little bit more peace with the world as it is.
I think they are. But I'll tell you, when I was in culinary school, there were some kids who were like 19 years old, and I heard some things coming out of their mouth that people who are my age are instilling in their kids. So,
well, that's not good. No. All right, Rick, thank you very much. Isn't there a Doors song, the Soft Parade, where back there mm-hmm. when I was in culinary school?
Is that what? That's not what they say. Stop it.
Well, what was it?
No.
I can't even think what it is now. I am getting tired. Back there when I was in seminary school. Isn't that it?
Oh, well, that works for this show as well.
You know what I'm talking about? You know that thing we play
sometimes?
I know the song.
Peter, don't try to find it.
The Soft Parade.
Don't do it. Don't
okay,
do
all right,
it.
All right. I'm going to. All right. Here is Pete in Detroit. Pete, welcome to the broadcast.
How are you guys doing tonight?
We're good.
We're good, Pete.
Good. Okay. Now, I just want to say this objectively, and I'm not going to crawl through the phone or do anything. I don't think it'd fit anyways, but I am a Christian. I got saved, baptized, everything. And I think the one thing a lot of Christians forget, there's a couple things that I try and live by. Sometimes Christianity's worst enemy are Christians. And that's a reality. There's a lot of brokenness. There's a lot of hurt. A lot of people that feel a lot of deep pain. And Jesus was, the thing I can say in his defense, he was very much about the relationship, not the religion.
Well,
he was, that's really what he was about. He was more about, there's this wonderful quote in the Bible, and I'll just be really quick, that he said, like, there was a guy who came to the altar and said, I'm a screw up, I've messed up, I basically threw my life away, and this other guy came to the altar and said, I do this, look how great I am, look at this, look at that, look at whatever. And Jesus was pretty clear about which one he favored, so. Again, like, I understand where you guys come from because I used to be like that, but I've just had, like, one too many thing happen in my life to believe that there's, like, basically, like, nothing after. Do you know what I mean?
No. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Because I used to be like you guys.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
That's Jim Morrison.
That's
okay,
Jim
now
Morrison
I know what you're
doors.
Talking about.
Yeah,
you found it. You
back
were there.
It is back there when I was in seminary school. So that someone put forth the proposition, you can petition the Lord with prayer. In other words, pray. But this is what he's enunciating as Calvinism, where there is the elect, that that there is predestination. That was their deal.
Mm-hmm.
That people that were going to be saved were already there. And you know how you could tell them? You could tell the elect, the people that were going to sit by the right hand of God, by their good works. In other words, the wealthy.
Ah, ding, ding, ding.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, right. All right, here is Mr. Miller in Madison Heights. Mr. Miller,
how you doing?
Welcome. I'm good. How about you?
Okay, I didn't want to, I don't want to get off into me and all that other good stuff. And I'm not going to judge anybody. I will throw in the I because it's there. I don't go to just one church. A few years ago, I thought about it,
everybody goes to one church. They put on that three-piece suit, that little dress on their little girl. They head to the same church every week to impress themselves and all their friends. I seen that, and I'm like, I shook my head, and I said, you know what? I'm going to start going to every church just to see every religion.
Okay.
I don't know what I think I'm the mass majority. I don't know what I am. I know I believe in something good.
You're just you, man.
Bad.
You're just you.
I'm just me, and, wow, man, I'll throw a shout-out to all my Kung Fu brothers in Sterling Heights because of them, I'm more open-minded. Now, I accept people for who they are.
There is a church called the Church of the I Am. I am.
Yeah.
Maybe you could do that.
Well, Peter and I do have a church. We have to remind people from time to time, if you'd like to join it, it's open to anyone. It's the Church of the Dyslexic Dog.
Absolutely. All right,
Good
Mr. Miller, thank you.
Online.
By the way, I said that to my sister, and she said, what? So maybe people don't get it.
Like dyslexia, dog, God.
Yeah. So I would say, when mom and pop look in the mirror, they see only themselves. But when a dog looks in the mirror, he sees God.
He does.
You get it?
No.
Mom and pop? It's both ways? It's a palindrome.
Oh, yeah.
Palindrome.
No, I get it.
Okay. We haven't talked about palindromes in a long time, have we?
We've talked about drones.
Drones, yeah.
But palindrome. Not palindromes.
It's like rats live on no evil star.
Oh.
That goes both ways.
Yeah, right.
And what else? There's famous ones like that. A Toyota. In fact, a Toyota not only is a palindrome in that it reads the same both ways.
Yeah.
If you put the letters up as three-dimensional, you can, you know what I'm saying? You know, like they're cutouts and they were like set on top.
Like 3D.
Yeah. And they read the same way because they won't, if you read it from the back, they won't look backwards because it's all O's and T's and A's, right?
That's deep, man.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm gonna leave you with one thing.
Now that I've run about 10 miles during this show, and now I need to lay down.
Yeah, yeah, you're beautiful when you're sweating.
Thank you.
Anyway, here, speaking about religion, contraceptives are going to be covered in Obamacare, in the Affordable Care Act, which is excellent.
Yes.
According to this report in the New York Times, despite strong resistance from religious organizations, the Obama administration said on Friday it was moving ahead with a rule requiring most employers to provide free insurance coverage of contraceptives for women, a decision that has touched off a legal and political battle likely to rage for another year. And it adopts a simplified version of an approach to balance the interests of women with the concerns of the Roman Catholic Church and other employers with religious objections to providing coverage for contraceptives.
Now, isn't Viagra covered?
Forget. Well, I don't know if they would be into that either.
Don't you know?
No. I'm not up on it.
No pun. You didn't even mean to do that.
Yes, I did. They got 400,000 comments on this law because they said what there's an exemption included for churches, but many Catholic hospitals, schools, universities, and other religious institutions will have to take steps so that the coverage is available to employees and their dependents. Now, I don't get this. They don't
want
them.
That's not going to go over well.
They don't want them to have contraception, and they don't want them to have abortions. What must they want?
Babies,
whether the people want them or not. Here's what Kathleen Sebelius, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The health care law guarantees millions of women access to recommended preventative services at no cost. Today's announcement reinforces our commitment to respect the concerns of houses of worship and other nonprofit religious organizations that object to contraceptive coverage while helping to ensure that women get the care they need regardless of where they work.
What are vasectomies covered under insurance?
Don't know.
Okay.
We'll find out.
Things to ponder.
Because
maybe more vasectomies.
Yeah, that would help.
Hey.
But how come? They don't want contraception. They don't want abortion.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But you know,
figure it out.
Yeah, you know, a lot of this now. You know, the Republicans are really have the bit in their mouth, and they have control of these legislatures through these undemocratic processes that we talked about early. And so they're trying to restrict increasingly the right to choose for a woman and the access to abortion like this.
Yeah, there's some crazy stuff going on.
This new rule in Texas would mean that, I think there's 42 clinics that do abortions, and if these new rules went into effect, there'd be five of them. And so these rules include, like, the width of the halls. I forgot all of them, but there are all these technical things like that. Doctors have to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. So the idea, and the Republicans say that this they care about the women. Oh yeah, and they're going to have
to of the halls.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's to close them. And, I mean, so the idea is that they don't even want to say they oppose abortion. This is for the health of the women, for the woman. They care about women. Does anybody believe that?
Not for a second.
Not for a second, indeed.
These people. Have things just gone backwards? Yes, they have.
But, hey, we're going forward.
We got a black president, and we went backwards. We're supposed to go forward. Yeah. Because all the people who are so full of hate and fear and ignorance. And on that note, we'll be back next week.
Yeah, stay tuned for the interviews. Thanks for listening.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
101 WRIF. Locking in everything that rocks.
Grown old.
RIM 81 Detroit. Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. The Vietnam War, as that recedes from memory, one would think that it would be discarded along with all of what accompanied it. Its history, its anger, the protests, the support our troops part for that war. But it stays with us for a lot of good reasons, and we continue to investigate that in order to learn about what is happening in our political and military situations today. Joining me is somebody who I've had the pleasure of interviewing two or three times before, at a minimum, certainly on his last two books, which were CNN's Tailwind Tale, Inside Vietnam's Last Great Myth, which is a story in and of itself. But the one that evoked the most controversy, in fact, when Jalene Jordan and I were doing a nationally syndicated radio show, we had our guest on for like a whole 3 hours, longer than any guest ever. And the book that he'd written at that time that was so controversial was The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. And it essentially said that the stories of Vietnam vets being spit upon, or soldiers returning from Vietnam and then were spat upon, were constructions of memory that hadn't actually occurred. And here, back, Jerry Lemke is back with another book which challenges our historic memory, or is it really historic myth? The book is called Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. And besides being an author, Jerry Lemke is a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross and in Massachusetts, right? Jerry Lemke, welcome.
Right, good to be with you. Yes, I'm in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester, Mass, as they used to say. Looks like, what does it look like? It looks like Worcester or something like that, but but it's, everybody knows it's Worcester.
Yeah, well, some people do.
Another book on Vietnam. Did I hit it, or are there some other reasons why are we revisiting this, particularly since you're not a professor of history or a professor of sociology? What's there that that tweaks your memory?
Well, the book is really more about American culture today, the post-Vietnam American culture today, how the war in Vietnam continues to play into our political culture. And you're right that it does. I mean, witness the Richard Blumenthal story of the last couple of weeks, him saying he was a Vietnam veteran when he was really not, and saying that he was spat on when he came home from Vietnam, when he had never gone to Vietnam.
Yeah, even physically assaulted, he said at one point. Yeah.
And the way Vietnam played also in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the whole support the troops, the jingoism, which you made reference to also, it really works against the backdrop that Americans, anti-war activists, were supposedly hostile to Vietnam veterans when they came home from the war. And, of course, kind of a central figure in that is Hanoi Jane, this image of the woman betrayal figure who some people hold responsible for the loss of the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I was surprised that Hanoi Jane, and if people that we have a wide range of ages listening to this radio station, so some people weren't even alive during the events of Vietnam. Others, of course, remember it. Many, I'm sure, listeners, at least some, actually fought it. And you're a Vietnam vet, right?
Yes, I am, yes.
Yeah, and I didn't realize this, you were in the chaplain corps?
I was a chaplain's assistant, which is not in the chaplain's corps. I was assigned to an artillery unit, and I did. There was a chaplain's assistant school at that time. Maybe there still is, and I went through that, and then was assigned to a chaplain in Vietnam in 1969.
And did you see combat or the results of combat?
No. Chaplains are non-combatants themselves, and the chaplain's assistant is formally a combatant. We do carry weapons, but the chaplains I worked for wanted to avoid combat as much as I did, so we did.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this. I mean, Hanoi Jane, I mean, I remember oh, I don't know, years and years ago, walking into what we called a vet's bar, and all of them were very much opposed to the Vietnam War, thought that they'd been used and abused by the government, lied to, and suddenly there's a big bumper sticker on their wall that says, Jane Fonda, traitor bitch.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, whoa, what's happening here? Where did this come from?
Well, there's a lot of that stuff around. The more popular bumper sticker around here reads, I'm not Fonda Fonda. And a lot of that stuff actually came from Waterbury, Connecticut in 1987 when Jane Fonda and Robert De Niro went there to film Stanley and Iris. Waterbury was used as a setting because it was a factory town, and the story is a factory town-based story. And there was a group of veterans there who did believe that Jane Fonda had betrayed POWs in Vietnam, and they wanted the town not to be used for her filming. And so they mounted quite an opposition to it. They were on national television. They were on the Mark Downey Show, who some of your listeners will remember. And they coined this bumper sticker. They didn't coin Hanoi Jane, but the bumper sticker, I'm not fond of Fonda, and a lot of other memorabilia that can now be found online.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Lemke, you seemed kind of taken aback when I mentioned that phrase to describe Jane Fonda, but in your book, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, isn't there a similar...
There's a lot, yes, and I quote that same bumper sticker that you mentioned, because a lot of the phrasing against Fonda is misogynist phrasing. A lot of sexualized imagery is used. There are urinal stickers with her image on those, for example, that some people have seen. So it's the sexual imagery is in designed to evoke the image of a female betrayal figure and the supposed animosity of Vietnam veterans for this one in particular, Hanoi Jane.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the cover of your book, with the title of that name, there is this shot of Jane Fonda, very young Jane Fonda,
yep,
as a real sex pot in Barbarella, and then beneath it is the infamous photo of her at a North Vietnamese artillery battery, which is probably what the origins of all the vet hostility towards her. And she, of course, has apologized for that.
Yes.
But still, she is sort of iconographically represents what? I'm not even sure what. I mean, one person can't lose a war. And even if she was like the most horrible, terrible person in the world and did a traitorous thing, why does she loom so large?
Well, the combination of those two photos is really what that's about. I argue in the book that she's despised so strongly, not just for having betrayed the military mission, as some people believe she did, but that she really betrays something more basic, which is the centrality of masculinity in American political culture. Manhood is very wrapped up with military prowess and military service in the United States and in Western culture in general. And a lot of people believe, you know, and I'm talking about academic people, writers, journalists believe that the loss of the war in Vietnam was taken as a blow to American manhood, and not just for veterans, not just for people who fought in the war and might feel that way, but that America and America's sense of itself as a military, you know, proficient power really took a blow in Vietnam because of our very sense of our ability to make war, our willingness to go to war, at the core of which lies our sense of ourselves as a nation of strong men and warriors, male warriors.
So the whole complex history, the military strategies, the enormous casualties on the part of the Vietnamese and the Indochinese, the U.S. casualties, all get kind of distilled down into this one person. So we're not talking about the view of events through some complexity of what reality is, but as I said, really just this icon of it all, which...
Well, not supposedly on this point. I mean, Fonda did go to Hanoi in 1972, and she made radio broadcasts from Hanoi over Radio Hanoi. She was one of many American activists who did that. She was, by that time, 1972, some 350 other Americans had gone, and many of them made radio broadcasts in which they denounced the war, they criticized the war, the conduct of the war. And Fonda, however, is alleged in her broadcast to have encouraged GIs to defect, to go over to the other side, or if not to defect, to desert the military. And according to the people who hold her responsible for the loss of the war, those radio broadcasts demoralized U.S. fighters still in Vietnam. Thing I point out about that is that there were very few left in South Vietnam at that time, and there's no evidence that any Americans ever heard those broadcasts.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, when did you leave the service in the Vietnam era?
I left in February of 1970.
Okay, so you wouldn't have been there
too early.
Yeah,
right. But you know, my experience does bear on that a little bit, because the radio broadcast from Hanoi, of course, went on all the time long before Fonda was there, and supposedly, you know, GIs in Vietnam listened to other Americans broadcasting from Hanoi also. And I, 1969, I have no memory whatsoever even of knowing about broadcasts from Hanoi, much less ever having heard those. One of the ironies is that we did listen to pirate radio in Vietnam, that is radio broadcasts made by other GIs who were anti-war and who were anti-military, and those we heard. But one of the ways in which myths like Hanoi Jane play is that they put in place, you know, a different imagery, and they displace the truth. And the truth on that one is that lots of soldiers in Vietnam by 1969 were opposed to the war themselves and making their own anti-war broadcasts over pirate radio. So people can get a glimpse of that in the film Sir No Sir about the GI anti-war movement. So those are the kind of things that I'm more interested in the book, is how these myths work within popular culture and within political culture.
Jerry Lemke is my guest in the Peter Werby Show. He's written Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. Hanoi Jane, in this case, is what Jane Fonda is called by some veterans. Now, the imagery, though, that you take on also in your book, The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, is that there are these valiant soldiers and their families and real good Americans that support our troops regardless of the war. And then there are sort of this amorphous, maybe you could describe in the popular imagery, at least what this is trying to create, that are hostile to the GIs themselves, but that wasn't the case certainly during the Vietnam era.
Right. There's no record of, you know, very very thin, if any, record at all of anti-war people being hostile to soldiers or to Vietnam veterans. That's the image that Hanoi Jane is supposed to help project. And of course Fonda. Again, Fonda was not active even in the anti-war movement at all until about 1970. And so, you know, she wasn't much of a player at all. And then when she was very, very supportive of GIs and very supportive of veterans, and really went out of her way to be helpful, to help end the war for sure, as many other people, you know, were about at that time, was, you know, the idea of, if you support the troops, support the soldiers, help bring them home, help end this war. And that's the kind of role that she was playing at that time.
Also, she, along with Donald Sutherland and other famous people, set up this traveling entertainment troupe called, in its nicest phrase, Free the Army, FTA, which meant something else.
Free the Army, Or the Army slogan at that time was fun, travel, and adventure, one of their recruiting slogans. And, yes, they set up this alternative to the Bob Hope Show, which was a traveling variety show that went around to military bases around the world and had been doing that since World War II. But Fonda, Sutherland, Holly Near, Jules Pfeiffer put together an anti-war troupe to do this, and they performed not on military bases because the military wouldn't allow them on bases, but they performed at nearby off-base sites and drew large audiences of GIs. Fonda was also involved, in your Detroit listeners, you know, would be interested in knowing she was involved in the Winter Soldier hearings in Detroit in 1970-71. At which Vietnam veterans made testimony about atrocities that they had seen or heard about in Vietnam, and she helped create those kinds of forums for veterans to speak at.
Yeah, and the idea, of course, that anti-war protesters were hostile GIs just confounds history, which
confounds history and helps, confounds, distorts, and helps erase the history. Again, the real story is that thousands of guys came home from Vietnam and joined the anti-war movement. And nowadays, most people have forgotten that. Students that I have at Holy Cross College, you know, none of them, even though some of them have fathers or uncles who were in Vietnam, they haven't heard of Vietnam veterans against the war. They haven't heard about that. But most of them have heard stories about veterans being spat on, or they've heard stories about Hanoi Jane. A common response I get when I tell story, when I say that I'm working on a book, because students will ask, what are you working on? I said, well, I'm working on a book about Hanoi Jane or Jane Fonda. First response always is, oh, yeah, my dad hates Jane Fonda. Or my uncle hates Jane Fonda. And the story that she betrayed POWs in Vietnam, that got into one of my classes a few years ago, and I really begin the book first chapter with this story that one of my students who was an ROTC cadet came to class one day with an internet message that she had gotten from her ROTC commander that read, yes, Jane Fonda did kill someone. And it was a story that circulates virally on the internet about Fonda going to Hanoi, visiting POWs, being given little pieces of paper that they wanted her to take home to their family members. She gave those little pieces of paper, according to the story, to their guards, who then beat some of the prisoners until three of them died. So my student, who was an ROTC cadet, was understandably, you know, interested in this, concerned about this, and wanting to know if this was true. So it works, you know, not only in popular culture, but the Hanoi Jane image, this icon, this trope, works also still within military culture.
But it's not. It wasn't true. She didn't do that.
That story is not true. Not even close to being true. The people quoted in that story, I'm sure many of your listeners have come across that story. The people supposedly who turned their little pieces of paper over to the guards named in the story say it didn't happen, and they're not great fans of Jane Fonda.
Well, let me, you know, Jerry, before we run out of time, let me ask you a couple of other questions. The book is Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. It's published by the University of Massachusetts Press, and there will be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And if you've got questions about this or want to comment, you can, from that site, you can email me, and if Jerry wants, I'll send them on to him. Jerry Lemke.
Oh, yes, sure.
Lemcke is the way you spell his name. Now, on the face of it, it does appear as though going to North Vietnam at a time when the United States was at war with this country, albeit undeclared and based on a whole set of lies, as we've come to find out, was an egregious act. Like, for instance, if I went to a Taliban-held area right now and sat, and of course, I'd only be aiming at drones now, right? But if I sat at an anti-aircraft battery, the way she did in North Vietnam, people would think this is absolutely, I might as well wind up with, what was the guy, Taliban John?
Taliban John, yeah.
Yeah. So why, I mean, this sounds in many ways, I'm sure, to most listeners as a defense of Jane Fonda.
Well, in the context of the times, it was not nearly as interesting as it sounds now, when you and I would tell that story. Many, as I said earlier, 350-some Americans had already gone to Hanoi. Many of them had done some of the same things that Fonda did. The sitting on the aircraft piece or standing beside it, it's not really clear, what she was doing there. She was being taken around on a tour is why she was there, and she had the photograph taken, but she wasn't posing, as some people say that she was. And it was really not very interesting to the press at that time. I think you're right. If you went to Afghanistan today, it would probably be of greater interest to the press than Jane Fonda was at that time. It really was not. Her trip did make the news, but it was not a front page story. And her trip made the news because she was reporting on the bombing of U.S. dikes, irrigation dikes in Vietnam at that time. And that's why the news people were interested in her. So the story of the gun and visiting POWs, all of that stuff has become much more important as the years have gone by, which, again, is one of the earmarks, one of the hallmarks of a myth or a legend.
Well, one of the things that I think people probably don't know is that great sections of the American people, certainly of anti-war activists and many GIs, considered the Nixon administration their enemy and not the Vietnamese people, to the extent that here in Detroit there was a national organization created called the People's Peace Treaty that met with the Vietnamese and declared peace, that thought that the Nixon policies, which were an extension of the Johnson war policies, was absolutely wrong, wound up killing 3 million Vietnamese, Indochinese, and destroyed their country. And so didn't see, I mean, I assume at the end of it all that Jane Fonda did not see the Vietnamese as our enemy.
Oh, that's true. That's correct. Certainly by that time. And I think what you're pointing out is that her view was very in step with the view that not only many Americans had at that time, but many prominent Americans had at that time. And, we're quite angry at the Nixon administration for continuing to prosecute the war. So again, Fonda was not not an outstanding figure.
Well, hey, let me before we're almost out of time, and
sure.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but you wrote a book. You say it's actually not about Jane Fonda; it's about Hanoi Jane, which are separate entities. Has Jane Fonda seen this book?
Yeah, yes, she has, and she's blogged very favorably about the book. People can find that on her blog, she was on Larry King about a month ago and said some nice things about the book there. So it's not a biography of Jane Fonda. The listeners have to look someplace else for that. It is really a study of a trope, a myth, a legend. It's really a study of Hanoi Jane, much more than it is a study of Jane Fonda.
So in preparation for the book, you did not you didn't even interview her.
I did not interview her, no. I have talked to her, but actually we talked more about my book, The Spitting Image, that came out in 1998. And when I told her I was working on a new book, she said, "What's it about?" And I said, "Hanoi Jane." And she paused and she said, "So it's not about me."
Well, she
and I said, "Right." And she smiled and she said she liked that because there There are enough books about Jane Fonda, she said.
Well, we had 60 seconds left. I assume that there's probably some people that are going to take me up in my offer to angrily respond to what you said. What do you have anything to say to the Vietnam vets or the descendants of them that aren't convinced by that she was anything other than this horrible person that was one of the big causes of the loss in Vietnam?
Well, I would love to hear from them. I would love to, be able to talk to them, exchange email messages with them. Love to hear their side. There's a lot of stuff here that's historically inconclusive. You know, there's room for debate, discussion, alternative points of view. I'm always inviting people who might have information that I don't have. To get in touch with me and to bring that kind of stuff to my attention. You know, for example, her broadcast, did you hear, your listener, did you hear Jane Fonda broadcast from Hanoi? I haven't found anybody yet, credibly, who says that they heard her. I mean, people who say they heard her in 1968, which is before she made the broadcast. But something like that, I mean, I can never say never.
All right. Well, I can give people the – in fact, we're completely out of time, so I should do this quickly. Yeah. You can write me, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, website is .com, but at calltalkyes@yahoo, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I will send them along to Jerry Lemke. The book is Hanoi Jane, just published by the University of Massachusetts Press. The subtitle is War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. A generation later, the controversy and the debate continues, and well, it should. Jerry Lemke, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Good to be with you again.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Hey, have you seen those big, ugly, nasty, black piles of stuff down on the Detroit River? Well, if you've been following the news, you know there's been great community and activist opposition to it. They consist of something called pet coke. It's just another one of those byproducts, and we're told by the people in charge, that is the environmental quality people in Lansing, no problem. A lot of other people think there's a great problem, including the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. Joining me is Kerry Addis and Stephen Seward. They're activists with the group Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. And Kerry Addis is also an aquatic ecotoxicologist as well. They're in the studio with me. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, so tell us, what are those big piles of what are called pet coke? That's P-E-T-C-O-K-E. It's not a drug for your little animal companions, right? What is pet coke?
So pet coke is the result of the refining process of tar sands or oil sands that come from Alberta, Canada, through the pipelines and to the Marathon refinery downriver.
So this whole thing about the Keystone pipeline that President Obama has still not made a decision about, we're already getting the results of it.
Right. This is all combined with that larger action and these larger things you see happening around the country. This petroleum coke started piling up around March, and there was two main piles. One was at the Detroit Port Authority, and that's the Nicholson Terminal and Dock.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is at Detroit Bulk Storage, which is owned by Maddie Maroon down on Rosa Parks and Fort Street.
Now, Maddie Maroon, who we know, owns the Ambassador Bridge, mm-hmm. and tried to get a little referendum passed that didn't work for him. So he's not the, again, well, let's put it bluntly, he's sort of the villain in this?
Right. Well, I could say that. Yeah. He has a history of going about his business without getting the proper permits and clearances, and that's what happened here. These piles were done illegally. They're dumping these things right by the river without the proper permits required, and they're doing it against regulation, like twice the height it was supposed to be. At one point, they were three stories tall, and that just creates an enormous amount of fugitive dust that goes into the residential neighborhoods nearby.
Now, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, says that they're inert and won't hurt anyone.
Well, when it's – so if you have a jar of it on your counter. It's inert and not going to hurt you. If it's stored properly, it is mostly carbon, and there are a lot of constituents that are very, very toxic. So the way that they're storing it right now is it's not covered like it's required to in other states. It's, like I said, it's above the tree line, and they're not able to contain the dust. The way that it's stored now is it's nothing to do with what they're considering inert and not toxic. There's things in there. If you look at the MSDS, the data sheet, you got nickel, chromium, lead, and PAHs, which are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Those are extremely, we know that those are carcinogens, mutagens, and teratogens. Carcinogens obviously cause cancer. Mutagens damage your DNA and can cause cancer from that or other serious issues. And teratogens cause birth defects in mothers. So all these are
not good stuff.
Yeah,
not good stuff we want blowing around.
No. And if you saw the dust, we have a friend who's a lawyer that lives in the lofts, the reclaimed Hudson's lofts, which are very nice. And they just are right, like maybe 1,000 feet from this from these piles. They're just covered in this dust. You can see it on the windows. You can see it blowing in. She has to close her windows all the time now.
Now, there's lots of ways to go about opposing this, and one of it was through direct action. The Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands held a rally and demonstration last weekend at the site of these pet coke piles. And Stephen Seward, tell us about it. What happened? And there was even a little civil disobedience, huh?
Yeah, well, we decided that we wanted to raise awareness on this issue. And ultimately just stop them from doing it.
So you people showed up, said at a rally?
Yeah, on Sunday, June 23rd, we all met at Clark Park for a march and rally. And we headed from there down to Fort Street and Rosa Parks, where we kind of set up a little camp and got ready for the morning where we blocked the trucks from coming in.
So you blocked them, and there's this big truck I saw on Fox News, an account of it, and there's a bunch of you standing in front of this huge waste hauler, right, filled with pet coke, and what was that like? Were you in the front lines?
At first.
Yeah?
It was kind of intense, having a truck lurching forward at you.
I was going to say, what happened? Did the when you stood in front of this truck carrying the pet coke to the big piles on the Detroit River, what did the driver do? Did he go, oh, I better stop and just stop cold? Or you say he actually lurched toward you?
Oh, yeah. He kind of pulled forward a few times. He was pretty upset, possibly understandably so. I don't know how things went for him that day. But
yeah, and he, as is said in a lot of, he had a job to do. He was just following orders. Right.
Well, I mean, we've heard that before.
Yes, that's exactly my point. And what's it like? I mean, to some extent, you were risking your life, you know, for a pile of pet coke. I mean, what's the motivation there?
Well, I don't know if I'd go as far to say that, but certainly, yeah, the motivation is to raise awareness, you know, get some media attention, and to stop them from dropping pet coke in the river.
Which you did.
Right? Yeah.
They actually turned around. We stood there the whole day, despite several police warnings, threatened, several misdemeanors and stuff, and we said, no, you know, we're staying until these trucks turn around.
Why do you think they didn't arrest you?
I think there could be many reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, to some degree, Detroit police probably sympathize for what we're doing.
Yeah.
And they also had a lot going on.
I just want to go back a little. I mean, I think you were, you know, being modest and didn't want me to make you like some hero, you know, risking your life. I think when you stand in front of a truck, there's a risk there. And, I've seen other situations or read about other situations where people thought, well, I'm going to lay on this railroad track because the train would never dare to, you know, to run over me. And now, you know, it's a man minus his legs. So.
And that at the beginning, there wasn't all the media there. I think once the media showed up, there was a little bit less risk of like actual danger, physical danger and arrests happening.
Mm-hmm.
The police actually said at one point that they were concerned. They wanted to arrest us, but they were concerned about all the media attention that they would get.
Well, in either of you, what's been the reaction of people within the neighborhood?
Do you want to let me? Within the neighborhood?
Yeah.
Well, it's overwhelming support of the community in the neighborhood. There's a lot of community members out there. Even like local government folks are bringing this issue to light. Like Gary Peters and
sure.
John Conyers and,
yeah.
and all these guys.
Rashida Tlaib
is huge.
The state representative from the area.
Yeah. Right. She's been a big advocate for this.
Well, it used to be you can't fight City Hall. Now City Hall seems kind of vulnerable. And oftentimes the City Hall folks, if you can include the representatives and the congresspeople in it, it turns out to be the corporations. So it's a billionaire, Matty Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge and also the land where this Coke, Pet Coke, is being piled. But also we have here, which is such a strange sense of these words, it's Pet Coke but it's also this one part of it is owned by the Koch brothers, the K-O-C-H,
right.
So it's Coke.
It is Coke. So the Marathon Refinery denies any responsibility for these piles because it's already sold to Coke Carbon, which is part of the Coke Industries. So that adds another layer of very large corporate influence on this. I think, so City Council already, they had this, what do you call it? A resolution.
Mm-hmm.
They passed like unanimously that they wanted this shut down or cease and desist until the proper risk assessment
was taken.
The Detroit
City Council, yeah.
But they don't have any power to enforce that.
I was going to say they ought to talk to the emergency
finance. The mayor and the EFM. Yeah,
talk to the dictator of Detroit.
Right.
You know, he could just say, stop that. Yeah,
right.
I don't know.
So
yeah. But what is this stuff? So this is a byproduct of tar sands oil production, right?
Yes.
Okay. So then, it comes from as far away as Alberta?
Right. So this isn't just about like one pile of petcoke causing impact on this community. That's part of it. Obviously, it's very important for this small region. But on top of that, it's the last end in this huge. Probably one of the most environmentally devastating processes that we've ever undertaken. And it's just enormous from the place where it's extracted in Alberta
mm-hmm.
to the transport in these pipelines to where it's refined and ultimately stored and sold.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you start in Alberta where they are near mostly indigenous land, Aboriginal land.
They're spoiling that.
Stripping.
Yeah.
They, you know, they deforest, they strip it down, they take all this tar sands, they use an enormous amount of water. I have it written down somewhere to process it. Something like...
Because now the price of petroleum is so high that it suddenly... Before, they always knew this was there,
right.
but it wasn't cost-effective. Now, because of the price of crude, it actually is so under their...
Right. It's very cheap, relatively. So they do... Oh, there it is. 12.3 trillion cubic feet of water per year to extract it, because you have to extract it from the...
Wow.
Sand.
You sort of blow this water into it. So it's
right,
it's
and
like,
then it's
is it like
in,
fracking or is
it's left
it fracking?
In tailings. Well, it's not fracking per se, but
it's similar.
Yeah,
yeah.
They have to extract it from the sand, and then all that water ends up in tailing ponds, which aren't really. That's a whole other story. So then you do that, you thin it, you dilute it with natural gas products to make it less viscous because it's
mm-hmm.
extremely, extremely thick and you can't really pipe it very easily. So then you put it under pressure through these pipelines. If you look, there's a lot of studies. Let's see, Queen's University did something in these lakes nearby where they're doing this, where they're extracting it in Alberta, and they found the levels of PAHs, which are those polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which we know are carcinogens.
Mm-hmm.
The levels are 23 times higher in those lakes than they were before they started these processes, and this is where people are getting their fish. There's a lot of, like I said, a lot of indigenous land. So that's where it's starting. Then you start with the transport, and that's where the Keystone XL pipeline comes in. There's already hundreds of thousands of lines of pipeline under us right now, and they're just expanding that exponentially.
How do and the petcoke is that's piling up on the Detroit River?
Right.
How is what, and that's a waste product?
It's a waste product. So once it gets through all these pipelines, which I have a bunch of crap to say about that. Once it gets through one of those pipelines to the refinery, then they refine it. Mm-hmm. And I forget the percentage of it that turns into petcoke, but it's a really high percent. Do you remember?
So it has it actually has a commercial use, the petcoke does?
Well, really, it's they need something to do with it because they're creating it's like 1,800 tons a day of this stuff at the refinery. I found that I have to find the reference for that, but that was said by one of the...
I think, you know, a lot is significant.
Tons and tons of this petcoke is created. They need something to do with it. It's extremely low-grade, very, very low-grade fuel. It's when you burn it, it's supposed to emit 50% more than, like, emissions from the dirtiest...
Oh, so they actually burn
petcoke. They burn it. We're not supposed to burn it. Yeah. You can't get any new permits to burn it. If you have an existing permit from, like, a while ago, like Monroe. Monroe is starting to test burning it, mixing it with coal. But most of it's sent overseas to, like, China. Coke industry sells it to China. And
the funny thing about that, about Monroe using this petcoke, is that they had a spokesperson say that they've got state-of-the-art equipment, safety equipment, for burning this petcoke, so it's okay, but they don't... The problem with the petcoke is it burns somewhere around, like, 50% more carbon per ton, which, as you know, we all know, carbon is like the key ingredient in global warming. So their state of the art equipment isn't meant to reduce any of the carbon emissions.
Well, I've heard it said that if this Keystone pipeline goes online and it's approved, and I'll bet you that great environmentalists in the White House will in fact approve it, unfortunately, it's game over. That will be result in so much carbon being expended.
Right. Game over. That's exactly that hippie lowlife at NASA, Dr. Henson, said that would be game over. He called it the fuse to the largest carbon bomb on the planet. Yeah.
And you say that ironically.
I absolutely say that ironically. I'm just so sick of being called a jobless hippie when I'm obviously not.
When you actually, you are an aquatic ecotoxicologist. Carrie Addis is my guest. Also, Stephen Seward. Both of them are activists with the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. And if you're just joining us, one of the things they did last Sunday, held a rally in southwest Detroit and marched to the petcoke piles of waste on the Detroit River, had an overnight sit-in, and then in the morning actually stood in front of a truck bringing in more of it and stopped it. Well, then, as people with other pursuits and jobs and studies and all that, you went home. You had to, right? They're getting paid 24/7. You're doing this as somebody who cares about the environment and the world in which we live. So, as we're sitting here now, are they just bringing more and more of the stuff there?
Yes.
Yeah. That's the long and the short of it. Mm. Well, you know, one of the things that concerns me, it probably has concerned me all the years that I've been an activist, is how, and I hate to say it, how little people respond. I mean, there's people that have this passion for the environment or impassioned for civil rights or civil or anything, anything that tries to make either protect our world or to make it better. And you would think, for instance, that rather than in this one news account I'm looking at said there was about 30 of you or something, why there wasn't 3,000 or 30,000? Is that discouraging? You know, it never stops me, but it always is a little discouraging to me. What's your sense of it?
I don't find it that discouraging. I feel like people are going to come around as we put more effort into this and just continue talking to people and explaining them what's going on. What's more discouraging is when I have people telling me things like, shame on me for victimizing 48217, which is the area code, it's a zip code that's being highly affected by Marathon Refinery.
Oh.
The third most polluted in the country.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
First most polluted zip code in the Michigan and the third in the country.
Wow. Well, what you know, one of the things that we as consumers find, we just we get the end product of it. I mean, we get a little tablet or an iPhone or something like that, and some of us that are really aware knows what went into producing it, everything from the raw materials, the plastic, the metals, and all of that, and probably maybe we're most focused on the conditions under which people work. But you know, it's become not a luxury; it's become a necessity, like an iPhone or an iPad or something. And in the same way, people they want
want to be able to heat their homes. They want to, you know, they get mad when gas gets to be, you know, $3.89. And now, hey, you know, $3.29, everything's cool, without realizing the social and environmental and health costs. And so there is this is, you can use this, a head in the tar sands, right? I just thought of that. Head in the tar sands. What, I mean, and what we're doing here is trying to bring some awareness, but it's, in a lot of ways, people don't see a realistic alternative.
Well, the amount of money and subsidies from our taxes that we give the oil industry to maintain doing what they're doing is, if a fraction of that was diverted into alternative energy research and science, which they seem to just cut science all the time. They don't seem to care much about us anymore. But if that happened, like, it would be completely feasible to get more and more away from these dirty energy systems and into alternative, cleaner ways that wouldn't have the same massive impact on the environment as what we're doing and we're told is the only way right now.
Mm-hmm. One of the times when I first started doing these interviews, there was, that's a long time ago, the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. Mm-hmm. And I talked to this, oh, no, I didn't talk to him. That's right. I saw it on television, and there was a guy in a hazmat suit. Looked like just he was wearing, you know, white stuff over. And he's, and they said, aren't you frightened to go into there for your health? And he said, I'm more concerned about not having a job. So people like, you know, the construction unions and pipe fitters, all those people that are going to have jobs and do have jobs, like in North Dakota and what have them up in Alberta, they say, you know, hey, you know, that's fine for you, you know, Mr. and Ms. Environmentalist. But, you know, what about us? I got to feed my family. I got to have a job. I got to have my truck to bring this Petco down to the Detroit River. Sure.
The jobs argument is one of the most egregious ones I see that they have done to justify what they do. And people tend to, as long as people throw jobs, like the promise of jobs to them, they'll let them get away with anything, right? They've promised, TransCanada promised 20,000 jobs would come from this pipeline.
That's who's the pipeline, yeah.
Yeah, so 20,000 jobs. Well, the State Department and some independent analysts think maybe more along the line of 4,000 temporary jobs and mm-hmm. 20 permanent jobs. And I don't think that 20 permanent jobs throughout six states is worth the ridiculous amount of damage that it's doing. This pipe, like the Keystone XL, is going to cross over 1,700 bodies of water. Well, did you hear about what happened in Kalamazoo River?
Sure.
When the Enbridge exploded and they quickly ignored.
Yeah, that was a pipeline.
Right. They ignored signs for 5 years that was going to happen. And it's still, there's 100,000 gallons still on the bottom of that river that they can't clean up because it's so heavy. That's another problem with tar sands is it sinks down. You can't skim it up like conventional oil. If you spill that, you can just skim up off the top.
Yeah.
This stuff sinks to the bottom and it's almost impossible to clean up. And it devastates aquatic ecosystems, which is my focus.
You know, I was, when people say Fox News, a lot of people think about, you know, those guys on that television show. But local Detroit, which is staffed by news people, are staffed by people in the Broadcasters Union, of which I'm a member. They not only had a great video, and by the way, we haven't really mentioned your website. It's d-cats, d-cats.org, and that's the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. And the Fox News was nice enough to put your seven demands in their account online, at least. And some of these things, like number two, that Mayor Dave, is he still mayor? No, I just figured it, I guess. Mayor Dave Bing shut down the docks and refused to let Petco into another community's backyard. Can he do that, you know? I mean, does he have the actual legislative or executive power? I don't know.
Well, I'm sure if he could, he'd be overridden by Kevin Orr.
There you go. all right. This is some of this, I think, is important because it's not just technical, this is, and I like this one, create new forms of working and living that don't force people to choose between a paycheck that puts food on the table and a job that jeopardizes the planet's ability to support life.
Exactly.
That's exactly what we were talking about
right.
before.
Because there are like tens of thousands of clean energy jobs in like Nebraska, and we have a lot of Republican governors and things over there that are pushing for clean energy because they have so many people employed in that right now. It's not like if you don't have a job transporting petcoke anymore, there's not going to be a job for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of awesome opportunities that we're just not even considering right now because of the oil industry.
Some of this, you know, people have said that, well, if we're not, if we're going to not wind up with enough you know, oil, we're going to wind up then affirming the nuclear industry. So, you know, because they say that's pollution free. Yeah, if nothing goes wrong and you can find somewhere to store the waste for $250,000, you know.
Right.
Well, we're almost out of time with Carrie Addison and Stephen Seward from the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. How can people, first off, how can they find out more information? The best place, go to the website, d-cats.org?
The website, or it seems that our Facebook right now is being updated more frequently.
Okay, that's good. And are there going to be more direct actions?
Yes. Oh, yes, certainly.
Anything right now that we can announce to people? I mean, because I missed. I was out of town last night. I would have been there. I don't know. You know, one of the things, Stephen, why I asked you about, I said I thought it was brave and risking your life to stand in front of the truck. I don't know if I would have. That's why. So maybe I'm just cowardly. Who knows? But what's up in the future for direct action and community rallies?
You can talk about that one.
Yeah. You know, I'll let Carrie take this.
Oh,
okay.
Well, I don't want to. So on July 14th, a lot of us are going up to Traverse City. There's a conference of people that are like MICATS, mm-hmm. Which is the Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands. There is some direct action camp trainings going on. But as for like local, we're focusing on outreach and community engagement right now. And we do have some things planned, but I don't want to. We usually don't let that out into the media until.
Oh.
Right.
Okay. We're expecting a pretty busy period of time between July 14th and the 22nd. We've got a couple actions planned. We've got an action camp coming up July 19th, which is where we will teach people direct action, do direct action trainings.
Okay, well, I will. I have a website, Peter Werbe. Pardon me, werbe.com, peterwerbe.com, and it has a calendar. And if you send me this stuff, I will put it on there because we're talking about something that is literally right in our backyard. And I'm going to be on July 14th. Is that a Saturday? I think it is. But yeah, I'm going to be hosting an environmental riverboat cruise that leaves from Windsor. And if people go to my website, they can, you know, hook onto that as well. And like everything, like the Detroit trash incinerator and these pet coke piles that are on the Detroit River, that all just blows right into Essex County, our neighbors to the south. So I want to thank both of you for being on the broadcast and bringing this, not only bringing this to our attention, because it's twofold. That, you know, what's happening is awful. But to know that there are people dedicated to being the core of organization and resistance is very heartening. So Carrie Addison, Stephen Seward, thank you so much. Once again, the organization is the Detroit Coalition Against Tar Sands. You can go to d-cats.org and my website as well. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. 101 WRIF. Oh,
ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bid online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Oh, my God.
Get all of Dave and Chuck the Freak's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. Brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. It's back to the links, July 22nd, the 2013 Riff Rockin' Golf Outing. Details at WRIF.com.